following is a presentation of Real Racing USA.
This is Joe Irwin.
And this is Wayne Jefferson.
From Jefferson Irwin Racing.
And you're listening to Real Racing USA.
When purchasing a technical product like brakes, there is no substitute for quality and experience. In the performance industry, no one has more experience than the brakeman. The brakeman has been designing high-performance solutions for a variety of applications for almost 40 years. The current products from the brakeman are among the most advanced on the market. The Tornado calipers are the only calipers in the performance industry to carry a U.S. patent number and their new line of pads and rotors. The Brakeman Super Brakes are solving brake problems on hard-use vehicles, from police cars to ambulances and a variety of fleet vehicles. So if you're towing a trailer, carrying heavy loads, or just plain want to extend the life and stopping power of your vehicle, it's time to call the Brakeman on the web at thebrakeman.com.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Real Racing USA Live.
Right live.
Here, live from the Karnak Studios. Well, Jack, it's about over, man. 07's just about in the books, man.
I was thinking about that today. You know, it's like people that work in the media and racing and people who work at racetracks and run traveling series, now's when the intense work really begins.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. Getting ready. Getting ready. I'll start it all over.
You start doing 2008 like now.
Right now. Yeah. You know, I mean, can you imagine what it's like up at East Bay right now? I know what it's like. I've been there for a couple of years. Crazy, man.
It's an Goody's headache powder is like handed out freely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, the 42nd annual Governor's Cup is in the books. Jeff Choquette putting his name on the trophy again, but what's really impressive is Dickie's back in the winner's circle.
Dick Anderson, known all over the place.
All over the place.
Now he's got himself a driver that matches his style, I guess you'd
and say. And who'd have thought it'd be Choquette, though? I mean, yeah, Choquette's a damn. I mean, he's...
Jeff Choquette won the ASA Late Model Southern Division Championship going away.
I bet he's leading the points in the most popular driver award.
Well, he might be. And, you know, he's had good success. He's all getting ready for the Snowball Derby, driving Dick Anderson's number 92.
Could you imagine if they pulled that off? The Cecil Williams, the Governor's Cup,
and then the Snowball.
Yeah, that is a tough one.
That's a tough one there, man. That's a big leap. The Governor's Cup for Florida... You know, the guys in Southern and Central Florida is a big one, and there's a tremendous amount of talent. Tim Russell, who's had some fair success on the ARCA series.
Right.
And, of course, Wayne Anderson. And, I mean, there's you know, some pretty good talent, but to step up the Snowball Derby is...
Big steps. I mean, if there's anybody from this area that I think can get it done. Now, Wayne Anderson has done it.
Yep.
Wayne Anderson has won the Snowball Derby, so it can be done from down here. But, you know, the thing, I think the biggest surprise to me anyway about the whole Governor's Cup deal was 33 cars showing up.
Yeah, and Ricky Carmichael running with the big guns.
Oh, no doubt about
it. Now, he's going to Busch or something next year? Is that what?
Is he going Busch or Busch East or
something?
Something.
Well, I'll tell you what, he was surprising. He finished seventh in the Florida Governor's Cup running with the... You know, the Wayne Andersons and the Tim Russells and the Jeff Choquettes. And, that was surprising.
Big congratulations to Jeff Choquette and Dickie Anderson, though.
Yeah.
It's good to see Dickie smiling again. He wasn't smiling last year.
Well, you know, one of the things that somebody had said something about this when at the Cecil Williams Memorial race where Jeff put on a show to win. And it was about Dick Anderson looking like Dick. Well, I'm going to tell you what. In the Florida Governor's Cup 200 lap race around High Bank, New Smyrna Speedway, newly paved, faster than all get out. He looked, that car looked like Dick Anderson was driving it. I mean, you know, when Dick was driving, the thing with Trademark was, once he got to the front, it was like David Steele. It's almost like the same as David Steele in sprint cars. You know, he works his way to the front, and once he gets in the front, you know, this game's over.
Yeah,
and that's
done
the way,
deal.
And that's the way it looked just like that. It looked just like Dick Anderson was driving the car, and he got stronger as the race went on. The last 50 laps, he just got stronger and stronger and was.
He also had two major players that weren't there either. Because B.J. McLeod was fast.
He broke.
And the Enforcer.
The Enforcer. The Enforcer almost got enforced right off the bat. I don't know what he was thinking. We talked to Jeff Choquette last night. And Jeff, in last night's on Inside Florida Racing, described, he said something to the effect, I don't know what he was thinking. I think he thought it was lap 200 or 190 or something, because he jumped up right next to him on the start and was banging on his door for five laps on the first five laps of the race. And he broke something in his, it was like oil pump or something. But Choquette was like, what is this guy doing?
Enforcing, no doubt about it.
Yeah. He would have been enforced if he had wrecked that car on the
front. Like the good old days.
There would have been some enforcing. They might have needed them sheriffs that they had out there, man.
We could have replayed Dumont's interview again.
I'm telling you. But, yeah, it was pretty wild. It was fun. It's always fun to go to those big races. And then the next big deal is the Snowball Derby. And, man. Hey, what happened? In the nasty car deal, man.
Jimmy Johnson, back to back.
You know, I was watching that little thing there. I didn't watch the race, of course. I was watching one of my favorite NFL teams get their butt handed to them again. But, you know,
they did good in the first half, though.
I remember. They always do. they're the master of the three-point loss. They got the three-point loss down.
Yeah.
They set it up that way.
Kind of like Norv Turner taking a good team and turning it to crap.
Exactly. But, you know, I remember when Jimmy, you know, he was an ASA guy.
Yeah. Champion.
He was a champion. Rookie of the year, and then went on to become the champion of the ASA. Mm-hmm. And, matter of fact, we're going to have, just as a note, we're going to have the president of the ASA late model series on our O'Reilly ASA Fastlane show tomorrow night. And tonight, as a matter of fact, in about 6 minutes or so, we're going to speak with Dennis Huth, who's also involved in the ASA.
You know, there was another guy who said he had the Midas touch in racing. But, you know, you look at the credentials of Dennis Huth, this guy really has the Midas touch. I mean, the guru of the Craftsman Truck Series.
Speaking of Stan Cullen, former owner of East Bay Raceway, who had a thing. You know, I wish I could find a copy of that diatribe. Remember he had a whole long thing?
Oh, yeah.
30-page deal or 10-page deal.
I got it.
You got it?
Oh, I still got it.
The Midas touch.
Yeah. That and 6 years of track records.
There are some characters in this game. Sometimes they got tons of money. Sometimes they're, like, poor. They stand on the street corner and beg for race fuel, but there's some characters in this game, man.
Oh, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. God. Well, Jack, 5+ years I've been announcing out at DeSoto Super Speedway. I'm going to call it a career after this weekend. Going to do the Florida 400 and the...
You going to work for Fast Car?
No, I'm going to do some writing and do a little radio, do a little traveling, do a little relaxing next year. So that should be fun. That should be lots and lots of fun.
Yeah, so also on tonight's show, we're going to talk to Dennis Huth, who was the guy who actually created and founded, I guess, I don't know the exact details myself, the NASCAR Craftsman Truck Series.
But, which I think is probably the tightest racing in NASCAR right now.
No doubt. That's what people have been saying for the last 5 years or so, at least. And we're also going to talk to... Troy DeCare, who won the TBARA Wing Sprint Championship for 2007, the Tampa Bay Area Racing Association, known all over the country, and is no doubt the outstanding stellar star shining in Florida racing. That series is brings out the fans like nothing else, dirt or asphalt. It's the show, and Troy DeCare won that championship. They got a new New president.
Well, and I guess he's the vice president or the director is Troy DeCaire's dad, Terry DeCaire.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Troy DeCaire is going to be with us and share his experience in that series. And then we're going to talk to the man.
The guy, the man who wrote the book.
He wrote the book on race officiating.
On Tech Books.
Yeah, buddy.
Yep.
Fritz Augustine, yep. Retired after 49 years. Of telling people what time of day it is.
No doubt. No doubt. This guy, some of the stuff I've read about this guy, from cutting tires to verbally throwing people out and being best friends the next week, but never losing control, Fritz Augustine.
People make jokes about, you know, people being legends in their own mind. Well, let me tell you something. Fritz is a legend in his own time. I mean, this guy is like...
True legend. Phew. True legend.
He's fun. He's fun. Just I've been at a racetrack. Of course, he's been working with the Hooters Pro Cup Series for the last number of years, 10 years, whatever. And he always does Snowball Derby, or frequently.
Right.
But, you know, sometimes I've been to the racetrack, and I've just watched Fritz for an hour. just follow Fritz around on his little cart and watch Fritz, man. He's a character. And,
yeah.
So we're going to talk to him about his experiences in racing and get some maybe we'll get some tips on how this thing's all going to turn out. And then we're going to talk to Joe Schmalling, who is the competition director for the new Super Cup Series.
The old steel body Hooters Pro Cup cars,
as Rob Bonehead Elting said last night. Sleds.
The sleds. Well, you know, every late model driver I ever talked to that did run Hooters Pro Cup called them exactly that.
Sleds.
A sled.
I asked BJ McLeod after his first time being in a Pro Cup deal. He said, it was so slow. Of course, he was used to driving one of them light 2,700-pound,
right.
800-horsepower monster. Yeah. What do you call them things in the Southern All-Stars series?
Super duper late model.
Yeah, buddy. I'll tell you what, let's take a quick break here, and we're going to come back with Dennis.
All right.
Dennis Huth. Let me line this stuff up. I'm not sure if I got all this. Are we ready for this?
Are we ever ready for this?
I don't know. Let's see. We don't want that.
How about something else?
Yeah, I got it.
All right.
We'll be right back.
O'Reilly Auto Parts ASA Fast Lane. Only on Real Racing USA. Meet the racers of America's most exciting short track racing series every Wednesday night from 8 p.m. until 9 p.m. From the Milwaukee Mile to Bristol Motor Speedway, Five Flags in Nashville, the ASA is the racing series where young talent meets wily veterans in extreme short track competition. O'Reilly is America's auto parts store, and the ASA is America's premier late model series. O'Reilly Auto Parts ASA Fast Lane gets you close to the action and behind the scenes with the real stories from the drivers themselves. The O'Reilly ASA Fast Lane, only on Real Racing USA.
Are you ready to win? If so, it's time to move up to 5-Star Race Car Bodies. 5-Star Race Car Bodies designs and manufactures the highest quality race car body components. Short tracks, drag strips, road courses, and even in the desert, 5-Star has one driving passion: to help you win. 5-Star Race Bodies designs and manufactures for NASCAR, Grand Am, NHRA, IHRA, SCCA, Short Track Asphalt, Short Track Dirt, USAC, USAR, Hooters Pro Cup, and the ASA Late Model Series. Find out more today at 5starbodies.com.
CarNet.com, your online racing community since 1997. CarNet.com is racing classifieds, racing photos, racing news, lively racing message boards, chat rooms, multimedia, and so much more. And if your race team or racing business needs a website, or your website needs a fire lit under it, look no further than CarNet.com. From affordable web hosting to fancy flash animation, CarNet gets it done.
We're back on Real Racing USA Live. Jack, we got a caller on the phone?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we finally hooked up with Dennis Huth, who, from what I understand, was influential in a huge way in creating the Craftsman Truck Series, also is involved with the ASA, and we'll introduce him now. Welcome to Real Racing USA Live. You there, Dennis? You hear us okay?
I can hear you just fine. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're fine. So, welcome to the show, and man, everybody I talked to over the last month or so when we decided that we wanted to talk to you, they said, you got to ask them about the Craftsman Truck Series. So tell us a little bit about how that all happened and what the real deal is.
It wasn't people that I owed money to or anything, was it?
I don't think so. I don't think so, Dennis.
Well, I mean, if you're getting into a little history, I'm a little, you know, it's going to show my age a little bit, too, because I've been involved in actually most aspects of the sport, and the NASCAR Craftsman Truck Series was kind of one of those culminating, crowning glories for me, particularly, because there was, you know, there hadn't been too many new series started in quite a while for NASCAR, and I had a 17-year tenure with NASCAR, which really started off with a weekly program and dealing with all the various tours, and that's where I got to know the Bob Harmons of the world very well, because NASCAR ended up purchasing the All-Pro Series from Bob, and then the John McCarns, and purchased the Artco Series, and of course made that the Midwest Tour, and we started the Northwest Tour when I was up in Portland, Oregon in 1985, and then started the Southwest Tour the following year. So a lot of touring series experience over the years with NASCAR, and it was kind of ironic because four off-roaders from Southern California came in and said that they really wanted to race before people instead of all the desert rats and everything else that were, you know, the Gila monsters and all that. And asked us about racing trucks. And ironically, it fell upon deaf ears in the first conversation. And we just kept moving about our business because we had a lot of things naturally that were on the plate. And they kept hammering us. And finally, it came down to a situation where the more we looked into it, we saw that there was a... you know, that was the number one selling vehicle in the country, meaning the truck, and the Fords and Dodges and GMs all were looking for a new avenue to start selling some more product or at least advertising some more products. So we went out and I had a conversation with the group. Well, in fact, it was at the Hilton Hotel in Burbank, and it was one of those where I thought I was walking into about three guys that were going to talk to me about it and want to do something with it, and they had their attorneys, and there must have been at least 30 people in this room. So we hammered out the details and said that NASCAR would look at it, go forward with it, and we took a clean white sheet of paper and started working the series off as best we could to gain as much exposure as we could. And that's how we came up with having the four exhibition shows at the various tracks the first year. And then winter heat was still going on. We had a great rapport with the racetrack out there, so we decided to put a couple of, in fact, I think it was three truck races that first winter heat.
What year was that?
Well, that would have been, I'm thinking, 95.
Yeah, okay.
I believe. Because 94 was really the birthday of the series. In fact, the first truck was built at Mesa Marine Raceway in Bakersfield, California, by Gary Collins, in fact. And it was for one of the off-roaders. So I'm thinking in 95, and then we had the first true race in 95 at Phoenix, Arizona, where Skinner won it by, boy, it was a close margin over Terry Labonte. And that was kind of the inception of it. And then we just kept building upon it as best we could. Of course, if you think back over the years and some of the things that were done, and I'm not going to call them mistakes, but we had to go through the various gyrations because we were holding a lot of those truck races on short tracks in the United States. And, of course, a lot of short tracks don't have pit road capabilities. Every one of the races were televised, and we had six networks that were doing them. So we had to come up with some type of a stopgap method to get through the races, because most of them were about 200 laps or so. And that's how we came up with a halftime break and figured we could just kind of name it that you could go into the locker room and talk to the guys halfway through, and it kept the cost down on the crews, of course, too.
Sure.
How many guys they had to take to the track and all that. So it worked for a while, but then we realized that the excitement that people were used to within the structure of, at that time, Winston Cup and, of course, the Busch Series had a lot to do with the with having crew members and tire changes and the pit stops and all that. So we eventually moved into that as we were moving to some of the bigger racetracks. And some of the smaller tracks were working on putting pit roads in. So it was a good mishmash of, you know, various types of tracks that we were going to. But I'd still consider it that those, the infant stage of the truck series was still, it was a short track series to begin with.
Sure.
No doubt about it. You know, Dennis, after the Craftsman Truck Series was probably about 5 years old or so, several other racing organizations tried the trucks in different ways, including NHRA. And, NHRA's Pro Stock trucks failed miserably. But the Craftsman Truck Series just grew and grew and grew. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think the power of, even though I'm gone from NASCAR, I think the power of that NASCAR name still has a lot to do with it. You can attribute a good percentage of that. And the other thing that I think was important at the inception of the series, you know, everybody tends to, this is not a rocket science business. I mean, we all try to turn it into something that it really isn't.
Right.
And you know, as we move through the existence of these various tours or weekly tracks or what have you, we tend to really start looking towards what the competition is, and we lose sight of some of the important factors that do take place. And I mean, I'm from the old school. When I had my first racetrack, I was 19 years old, and I opened it in Northern California, and it was a little dirt track. And you know, I thought the whole time that I'm going to go in and be able to bust the chops of some of these drivers and tell them what I wanted to do and how we were going to do it. And I learned my lesson very quickly, because these are all very passionate individuals that are involved in this sport. You know, they're not doing it just for the fun of it. They're doing it because they want to win. And you try to disrupt that true meaning of them trying to win, and you can really disrupt the psyche behind them and where they want to go in this sport to begin with.
New promoters are learning that lesson every day.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And the issue really with the trucks, and I can honestly say that it was a clean white sheet of paper, because I remember after that meeting coming home on the airplane, I had that clean white sheet of paper in front of me, and I kept saying, oh my goodness, now what do we do? Knowing that it was all going to fall into place. But what we all did at NASCAR is we attempted to make sure that it was getting back to basics for a new series. And that comes back to, and again, a lot of promoters, and I forgot it for a while too, but, you know, it's the entertainment factor.
Right.
And it's making sure that the drivers are accessible, and making sure that, you know, that everybody has a real niche. In that first year, we actually called it the blender of motorsports there for a while, because we had the guys from World Outlaws, we had them from road racing, we had them from, when you got Sammy Swindell and he's out there with guys that have been road or oval track racing for a number of years. It's quite interesting to see a guy on dirt, you know, switch over to the trucks.
No doubt.
So it really, I would say that the success of it was one of those things that's always part luck, because you never know what's going to happen. But just the dimensions of the vehicle itself, how they performed at first, because if you look back at the photos, John Close has done a kind of a historical view of the trucks for the last 10 years. He's got a book out now. And he signed an autograph, or gave me a copy and signed it and handed it to me. And I looked back at the trucks, and it was like deja vu all over again, because looking at some of these these vehicles and the way they were built. And then I was up at Atlanta Motor Speedway for the truck race a few weeks ago. And, yeah, they've aerodynamically changed quite a bit. But as Schrader used to tell me early on in the series, because he and Bodine were pretty regular, he said, "Dennis, they drive like a brick. They look like a brick and they drive like a brick." He said, "There's nothing we can do to make them drive any better. So it's going to be good racing no matter what we do to them."
Do you think the fact that the trucks, fans, I mean, you go through a parking lot at racetracks and you see a lot of pickup trucks and a lot of trucks. Do you think that the fact that the fans could relate to them as perhaps they couldn't in my 90s, by the mid-90s, the cars used in NASCAR started not looking like cars that we all drive. Do you think that had something to do with it?
Oh, definitely. At that point in time, and I don't have the stats in front of me, but we ran some pretty strong numbers just to see where we were at. And I do remember that one of those stats that stood out in my mind was that everybody was driving a car of some type, but most people had an SUV, and most of the time it was a truck. So the two-vehicle family or the three-vehicle family usually had a truck involved. And in fact, you hit home on reminded me of something, because we had our first race at Sauga Speedway out in Southern California, and it was a race on TNN. And I remember that they didn't have enough power to supply this place. And Sauga Speedway, if you hadn't heard of it or what have you, it actually had a reverse camber to it. Turn 3 and 4, if it rained, the water rolled to the outside.
Or Hialeah.
Yeah.
And it was about the size of probably the table that you have in front of you now.
Right.
But it was fantastic race. In fact, Hornaday cut his eye teeth there.
Yeah.
And, in fact, a lot of the Southern California guys. But we had a little problem because they they didn't have enough power, and they had two big generators that were powering the TV trucks and all. And we remember about the first or second lap, Schrader and Jerry Glanville got into it, so we had to put both of them to the back of the pack. And we restarted the race, and about four or five laps later, the TV went down. And it come to find out that the guy that had brought both generators forgot to put fuel in them.
Oh, Lord.
It popped every switch and every, and you can imagine, guys are doing radio right now, but imagine a TV production.
Yeah.
I remember walking in, because Patty Wheeler was the production, in charge of production that night, and she sat her head sitting in her arms, and she went, "Oh, my goodness, I don't know how long it's going to take us to get it back up again."
Oh, no.
So we were doing what we could to pass a little bit of time, but as I came back up through there, one thing that stood out in my mind as I was going back up the grandstands into into the tower, and I looked out, and of course the lights were still on for the racetrack, but I saw a field full of pickup trucks. So, yes, I think that had a lot to do with it, and people could relate to them. And the brand identity really turned into something that was pretty strong. I mean, we noticed from Chevy and even Dodge, because that was their first intro back into racing
in
15 years. And, of course, when they called up and said, "We want to be involved," and I'll never forget it because Bob Weilberger was head of the program at that time, and he said, "We'll send you our set of rules that we can live with." And I kind of stopped for a second because Les Richter and I were sitting in the room on a speakerphone. I said, no, Bob, we've got the rules pretty well laid out. So, if you want to play, this is really what we have to do. And we were virtually designing those trucks on computers to begin with. Because the wheelbase was different and the bed was a different size, and trying to make sure that we didn't have one advantage over the next. And of course, Schrader's words kept ringing in my ear that they were a brick. We didn't want to mess up a good thing. But no, I think that what people were driving had something to do with it. They could identify with the brands, and it was a new product, and racing was very good. And we also found out that the racing was very good when we got to some of the bigger tracks, too.
One of the things that stands out with the Craftsman Truck Series now is, like, the Busch Series, your fields can be 60 to 80% of Cup drivers out there driving, whereas the Craftsman Truck Series has its own set of drivers. Dennis Setzer, Kenny Schrader. I mean, they all, you know, most of them are still regularly racing in that series.
There are a lot of, well, at first, if you remember correctly, there were quite a few Cup guys that were, because there was a lot of Cup owners. I mean, when Childress jumped
right
into it, and Hendrick, and, you know, we had a, again, we had a pretty good mishmash of competitors that were out there. And there were some Cup guys that were running it because it was fun, and Schrader being one of them.
Right.
And his response, and even Bodine's response, was there's really no advantage here. I mean, you can have a, you can be a good driver, which they were, and you can have some real good equipment, but it's such the infancy stage of it and how tight we tried to keep the rules. And of course, we were running a 9.5-to-1 with a small carburetor on it, and so the equalizer had a lot to do with, you know, with the racetracks that we were on, and how we'd, we had the halftime break, and, you know, the various other things that came into play. So it was exciting for those. I mean, I could go on and on for the memories and all the various things that took place at the racetrack. And, you know, Skinner just had a phenomenal year that first year in the Childress truck, and it was, you know, that was kind of the benchmark that was set for a lot of different people. But the amount of enthusiasm, especially at a short track, like when we went to Louisville, which, you know, I don't know how many turns Louisville had. At least it had to have five different turns in a third mile or whatever size racetrack it was. It was just the unbelievable. You know, and they all came off of there and said, we have no earthly idea what we're doing or how we're going to set up for this track. A lot of them hadn't been there before. And it's, you know, we knew right then and there we were going to have a great race. We did. I mean, we crashed a few trucks out, but it still turned into a good race because it was the unknown quantity, unknown factor for a lot of those guys. So, but the fans were, they were rabid.
Well, you know, and you said it started on the short tracks with the break at 100 miles and stuff. The trucks are still at the tracks, though. You know, we've got our own series down. Like, we've got two different series down here in Florida right now, and they're all over the country. You know, regular short track Saturday night classes.
Some of the
are
best
trucks.
Some of the best racing, and some of the kids in Florida. And I'm not sure about other places, but in Florida,
that's where they cut their teeth.
The kids are all the best drivers in the late models now. Most of them race trucks.
You know, I agree. It's a good stepping stone. In fact, I was just up at one of our ASA member tracks up at Adirondack Speedway, International Speedway up in New York, and the track operator was a little embarrassed because it was a bad night. It was, you know, people, the late models were crashing, and it was a slow show, and of course he wanted to showcase because he had a pretty good sized crowd too. And the trucks came out, his local class of trucks, and I think he had about 23 or 24 of them there, and it's a half mile racetrack. And I'm going to tell you, it was probably one of the best shows of the night. And it was a lot of young kids. I mean, I looked at a lot of them and thought, are they even old enough to drive? But they put on one of the better shows that night.
Yeah, we've had races in Florida in the last couple of years where the top three, I mean, in late model racing, where the top three were kids without driver's licenses who had raced trucks, you know, and they'd been racing trucks for 3 or 4 years, veterans at 16, you
yeah
know.
Well, if you notice that a lot of the newer series too that may come up, you notice the first 2 or 3 years the camaraderie that's there is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Because the competitors all want to see it, you know, shine. They want to be part of something that's a success, and of course everybody's talking it up. And like the one race that decided the championship between Jack Sprague and Ron Hornaday, well, Hornaday won it by 2 points when he was driving for Dale Earnhardt Sr.
Right.
I mean, it came down to the last lap of the race. They end up in the infield. They're shaking hands with each other, standing on top of their trucks. And, you know, one won the race, one won the championship. And that's the type of thing that's come out of that. And it seems like, even in talking to some of the veterans that are there, because I had a long chat with Hornaday while I was there in Atlanta, and, you know, it's changed. It's changed quite a bit. But you can still see that they know that they're putting on a great race. They know that they're putting on a good show that the fans like. And that's the thing that we tried to emphasize and hammer into everybody, including NASCAR, that's what we needed. The biggest challenge that I had, that I really was, It's probably the most sleepless night that I'd had, too, was I wanted to take the trucks to Daytona and to have the to showcase what they could do. And we had a couple of tests, and it didn't stand out very well, and there was a lot of internal discussion whether the trucks should have been on Daytona or not, and, you know, what the drivers were like. And after a period of time, we did set up a final test session. And I'll never forget it because the group went out, and I don't remember what the pole speed was at Texas, but we had come off of Texas, and Daytona, the speeds were just running a little bit slower than Texas, and I kept asking the guys, what is going on here? Well, come to find out, they were just so nervous about having to put plates, restrictor plates on, because that's what they figured what was going to take place. So I'll never forget it because I called a meeting of all the guys, and we went into one of the garages, and we had the drivers and the crew members there. And I just point-blank told them, I said, guys, if we don't get a true test, we're not racing here. We've got to know what's going on. And outside, you're going to see three different size templates for restrictor plates. And it looks like we're going to have to put one on Mon because we can't get a true test here.
Yeah.
And about four or five drivers, which will go unnamed right now, came up to me just after the meeting and said, listen, we just don't want to run those restrictor plates. And I said, give me a true test. So they ended up, about 20 minutes later, they all went out. And, of course, they increased in speed. And we ended up putting NASCAR radios on six of them, two Fords, two Dodges, and two Chevys. And I'll never forget the, you know, we've all got that hair on the back of the neck experience. I mean, I get it every time the national anthem's done and, you know, this gentleman starts your engines and they all fire up at once. And I'll never forget standing on the pit road of Daytona International and watching and listening to all the radios, because we were physically shifting them as best we could to make sure that Dodges could run with the Chevys and that, you know, there wasn't too much of a turbulence between the two and what was going to take place. And there was an expletive that was uttered by one of the drivers as he was coming off turn two, and he was probably 12 to 15 truck lengths behind a draft of two different makes of trucks. And that expletive told us something right then and there, because that truck probably gained 12 truck lengths in faster time than I've ever seen them gain at that point in time.
Yeah.
We knew we had a race, and we knew it was going to be a good race if the guys could just. And that first race, if you remember, right? I mean, the boat. If you take away the Bodine crash,
right.
it was quite a show.
And from, you know, from the humble beginnings on the short track, the clean sheet of paper, to when they took the green flag at Daytona, it had to be like watching your kid grow up.
It really is. I mean, it was a NASCAR package. There's no question about it. And I mean, Bill France had a huge influence. Brian France was on the marketing side of it, and we were on the administrative and rules side of it. And I mean, I was hiring people from various components of my history because I knew that this was so unique, so different, that we were going to have to really rethink our process here. Just putting them into the flaps that you see on the cars, that work on the cars, they didn't work on the trucks.
Right.
So we had to go in, and it was by pure happenstance, really, that we found out that a $1.95 piece of plexiglass in the roll cage area was going to do more than anything else we had tried. And that was after probably 20 days of wind tunnel time.
Right. We're talking to Dennis Huth, the godfather of the Craftsman Truck Series and the owner of the ASA. Let's shift gears a little bit, Dennis. How did you get involved in the ASA?
Well, I guess it was about 2004, I was contacted, the then owner of American Speed Association, Steve Dale. And Steve had conversations with me previously, had not met him before, but he had asked me if I wanted to become involved, because I had just come off a gig I was doing, IMSA, down in Pinellas Park. We had an office down there for IMSA and the American Le Mans Series. And the road racing gig wasn't quite what I didn't have my heart in it.
Right.
And so anyway, Steve said that he wanted to start looking at doing some member track stuff, and that was my early days at NASCAR. It was the NASCAR Winston Racing Series at that time. And we had taken 39 racetracks and kind of bumped it up to 100 sanctioned racetracks. And so Steve thought that it might be a good idea, and the more we discussed it. So I ended up, I lived here in Florida still, because I still live in Daytona Beach or Ormond Beach. But that was the kind of the humble beginning of all of it. And I think, you know, as history has gone on, people, I don't want to rehash anything, but Steve ran into some problems from various areas, and at the end of, or close to the end of the 2004 season, he realized that he was going to have to make some changes, and that one of those changes was to basically get out. So I ended up purchasing, there were three corporations. There was the Master Corporation, and then there was the ASA Late Model Series Corporation, which, you know, I heard you say something earlier that you've got Ron Varney on tomorrow night. And then the ASA Member Track Corporation, or LLC, I should say. And so I ended up taking over the LLC for the Member Track, formed a different corporation. I didn't buy the stock in it. And, of course, Ron took over his portion. And Steve still had control of the American Speed Association, which held all the contracts for the other two corporations because they were just sub-corporations. And we started off with, I believe we had five member tracks at that time. We had one regional series. And so I tried to put together the best business plan that we could to try to expand on all fronts and also do what we could to take the ASA name and maybe right what had been wronged, because I still felt that ASA brand had a very good following throughout the country. It also had a very strong impact on a lot of competitors. You know, when you talk about look at the new champion of...
We were just talking about that, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, Mark Martins and the Rusty Wallaces of the world, and even though none of us really had anything to do with that, it was still a brand. It was still a name, and it's still... You know, it was part of that history and that existence. So we expanded until this last year. And we've got 26 weekly tracks on board right now. We've got 11 regional series. And the regional series are very, very diversified because, again, I wanted to touch all segments of the racing society. People tend to forget that, you know, the old days that ASA was involved in a lot of different forms of motorsports. It wasn't just the one thing that was out there. But we've got a road racing series out in Phoenix called the ASA Pro Autosports, and we've got, of course, sprinters up in the Northwest, and a super modified division. We've got a truck division. We've got the modified division in the South, and in our new, well, now it's a year old, the ASA Midwest Tour, which absolutely had a phenomenal year last year. I mean, it was just unbelievable with how it took off, and, you know, for the super late models. And then we're involved with the ASA Northwest Tour, and then also the new formation of the ASA Southeast Asphalt Tour is coming along very nicely. So, in fact, we just we kind of hit some peak numbers on number of competitors that have applied and said they're going to be running full time next year. So, you know, it all was looking up, all looking good.
What?
And I went back at Steve probably about 9 months ago, and I told him that the one thing that was really kind of missing out of this is the owning of everything that surrounds what American Speed Association was. So he and I ended up cutting a deal, and I ended up buying the American Speed Association. So now contractually we've got all the contracts under that, and it was quite interesting because I personally decided I wanted to drive all the photos and all the video from the warehouse that he had him in Atlanta with a big old U-Haul. And I got him back down to the office, you know, before we put him into storage because we're getting ready to digitize all of them. But looking at some of those photos of Rusty and Mark and, you know, Johnson and guy standing in Victory Lane in various parts of the country having a cigarette in their right hand in Victory Lane, and, you know, the Winston, big Winston cap on, and, of course, the gals that are standing next to him with the big bouffant hairdos. And, I mean, it was unbelievable to go back in history and see all that history that was being made. So I'm kind of proud to be, you know, to be part of it, even though I didn't have a hand in a lot of it. It's still something. It feels pretty good to know that you've got ownership rights to all that.
You know, there's no doubt about that. What are some of the benefits? This is a question we get asked all the time, and I really don't have the answer to. I've talked to some track owners, but I'd like to have you tell us, what are the benefits for a member track, for a track to become a member under the ASA umbrella?
Well, I guess I better step back a step, because my years at NASCAR, and what we did within that structure, and keep in mind that during those years, we had a machine up there in North Carolina, and that machine was called Winston, and they were spending some pretty good money on all the local tracks. That's probably a day in an era that you know may not come back again, but they really put a lot into the weekly program throughout the country. And one thing that we did within the NASCAR structure was make sure that what the benefits of the racetrack had to do a lot with the financial end of it, with Winston, maybe a suite, or various other, the national champion and all that. All that changed. And I think if you look on any weekly track programs now, it has changed pretty dramatically. So the thing that my business plan, which has been laid out from the beginning, and I really haven't skewed too much from it, is to try to be able to spin on a dime and to look at the various tracks throughout the country and say to them, what do you really need? And to be able to find out if they're, you know, if they're looking for cheaper this or that, then can we help buy it because we've got a group buy? I mean, I feel that one of the components of running a weekly track, since I was there for 16 years doing that for my lifetime, was to try to help the track operator, not just by bringing him money, but by saving him money on the other side of it. So if we could do that through a group buy. The other part of it is I've always been a huge advocate, and I know that this steps on a lot of toes, or not a lot of toes, but a few toes out there with some track operators, is I wanted to have the best insurance policy in the country.
Right.
You know, that's one of the things that I will say that Bill France, I had the vision of from the get-go. In doing so many depositions with accidents and, you know, the various other components that go behind the scenes with an accident, there is nothing worse than having a, you know, standing talking to a wife that maybe is holding two kids and the husband has just been in a pretty serious accident, and all of a sudden you find out, or they find out, that the insurance that's on that weekly track isn't going to cover their bills. And that's a tough thing to do, you know, to answer those questions. So
sure.
That's where I really came in and said, this is something that we will not scrimp on. And if a track operator does come to me and says, you know, I don't need that much insurance, I don't want that much insurance, then quite honestly, we'll just back away and say, okay, you run your business the way you want to. But what I've found within most policies lately, because there's such a diverse group of health policies now, and especially when you get into workers' comp and all the rest of it, there's a lot of policies out there right now that don't cover you jumping out of an airplane, you know, with a parachute on, or driving a race car. So I believe that the racing insurance is becoming more and more important. Now, the issue comes down to, which at least I've found throughout the years, is most people, and I'm one of them, you don't think about that stuff until it happens around you.
Yeah.
Until something happens to a buddy or something happens to you.
You know, too, Dennis, one of the things that we've seen is new tracks owners, and there's been a lot of, you know, in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of turnover at racetracks. And one of the things we've seen is new track promoters come in, and that's one of the things that they just have no idea about, the extent of the risks involved or the nature of the risk. Shocked that they get sued so much, you know?
Sure. Well, and you're absolutely right. I mean, But the thing that hit me hardest was looking at the family, because I'm talking about the participant accident side, the medical side of it for the participant primarily. And I just don't want to see that happen.
Right.
I don't like insurance like everybody else, but it is a necessary evil. And why not go ahead and get the best? So what we've done is we've once again gone out in a group buy, and we put together it's a $500,000 participant accident medical policy, which is a benefit that comes along with a ASA Racing, member track or in any one of our ASA Racing series.
It's where a driver can feel more secure running at that track.
Well, and I always tell competitors that one of the first things that you should do is you should find out what kind of participant accident medical you've got at your track. That policy can range from $5,000 up to $100,000, and nobody's saying what's right or wrong. I just know that I'd rather have a little excess, and I don't fault track operators for trying to cut the best deal, because that's a costly sport to run. To run a weekly track is not the cheapest in the world. And you got the purse, and you got the health, and you got the insurance, and safety crews, and the rest of it, and advertising, and all that. So it's not that I'm trying to pick on them. I'm just trying to say that a competitor should know what he has before he walks in the gate. Because if they've got a separate policy that's going to cover it, and a track operator is carrying maybe $15,000 worth of coverage, maybe that's enough for their area. Maybe the hospital, maybe they're in a rural part of America. But from my standpoint, I just wanted to make sure that we had some of the best. And beyond that, we've got when you talk about the benefits of ASA, and it's kind of funny because I used to have a saying when I was selling the NASCAR weekly track, when it was the NASCAR Winston Racing Series. And I'd always tell a track operator that if you think that by hanging NASCAR on that front shingle is going to double your crowd or triple your crowd or what have you, you're mistaken. And I say the same thing now. If you think that American Speed Association, ASA, on your front shingle is going to double or triple your crowd, that's not necessarily so either. It still comes down to how much work you put into it, what kind of benefits you've got that you get back out of it. We've got a national organization, so naturally it's people that are racing under our banner have a national existence. And I'm seeing more and more out of like Circle Track Racing Magazine and Stock Car Racing Magazine. They do an excellent job covering a lot of our tracks and a lot of our series. So it's a good stepping stone. But on the flip side of it, I think it's also one of those things that as you look at it, we're attempting to give some real value. Not attempting. We are giving real value to a racetrack. And a lot of it's through the buying power. And now we're working towards the national championship theory for the competitors. And it's, as we grow, we're just making sure to add on. I don't want to grow it too rapidly. I just want to grow it as we go along and make sure that it's it's got a lot of positive and it's professional.
You're not passionate about this, are you, Dennis?
A little bit, huh?
Well, let's put it this way: I'm 57 years old, and my first racetrack was when I was 19. And the one thing that I found out about, no different than what, because I've listened to you guys too. You were talking a little earlier about the races in Smyrna and the rest of it. There's a passion there. You guys are, you're passionate about the sport. You love it. Well, I'm the same way, but I'm passionate about it from a little different perspective, or as Jimmy Buffett would say, that other point of view.
That's right.
And that is to hopefully make sure that the entertainment value is there, because anytime I walk into a racetrack, I'm trying to look at both sides of the fence. I want to see the competitor and what value they're going to gain out of it, the track operator is going to gain out of it, and most importantly, the fan and the sponsor on the other side of that fence.
Well, I'll tell you, Dennis, we're all on the same page here, because that's exactly why we got involved.
Exactly.
That's why we got involved in this media and created this thing about 10 years ago. I was a sponsor at a racetrack, sponsoring drivers and stuff and I wasn't doing it to help them. I was doing it to help me. My business is at the time, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And we're in this to promote, and that's really, I mean, we deal with promoters and track owners all the time, series promoters, and we're trying everything we can, doing surveys and research and, picking people's brains and running our mouth, because it is, It's all about entertainment.
It is about entertainment, and if I may take a second, I've gotten through the years, I've listened and I've kind of tried to monitor and I try to look at the psychology of this entire package. But yet, as I say it all along, this is not a rocket science business. But one of the things that if I can pass along to anyone that's out there, and this happened to me for real. I was sitting at left a racetrack, and I won't tell you what track, but it was not in this area. And asphalt track, I went to a restaurant. And there was a family of four, two young kids, probably one about eight or so, and it was about 10:30 at night, 11 o'clock at night. And, you know, my first thought was, what are they doing up so late? And they were talking, and I was kind of reading the paper or whatever I was doing. And pretty soon here comes a truck that pulls up outside the restaurant. And it's got a race car on the back of it. I saw this 8-year-old kid's eyes open up to the size of a saucer. And, of course, he's just bambling on and on. Now, Dad, look at the race car. And what I noticed was the father is saying, well, you know, I used to go to some races. Maybe we'll take some races. Why don't you talk to the driver? And you know, it was just the standard thing that you think you would hear. So they ended up talking to this competitor. The father helped force the issue, and the owner came by, and of course they had some shirts on and all had the theme and what have you. And I thought, you know, this is what motorsports is all about. It is about family. And everything was going fine until the kid asked, how did you do tonight? I won't repeat it because I don't repeat some things, but one of the things that came out of this guy's mouth just absolutely astonished me. And it was, you know, the stuff that all of us have heard, that the track is trying to cheat me or this is going on or whatever. And I think you can get the gist of what took place at that point in time. What I noticed in a matter of 30 seconds was a family that was enthused about going to the races shut down. A kid who was enthused about that race car shut down. And those 16 people that turn over a 4 or 5 or whatever it might be will probably never go attend that racetrack on a regular basis. So the one thing that I have found, at least through my years, is that no different than what you guys talked about, no different than what I've been talking about or anybody else talks about, we've got to self-support our sport and not talk. You know, yes, we can have problems, we can have complaints, we can have, you know, officials we know are going to make a few mistakes, and so are drivers, and there's only going to be one winner. But to generate our sport, I think we're going to have to continue talking positively about it and not necessarily turning off that new fan, because that new fan is a new generation that liked computers. And you know, maybe they're not out working on their own car. They're taking it to Jiffy Lube, not changing the oil like we did. Or, you know, or anything like that. So I guess my soapbox would be, internally, I think all of us, no matter how upset we may become, we need to keep pushing our sport and making it a positive tone. And you know, maybe take other sports out there. You never see a football player get on the camera after a game and say, boy, that was a rotten game. I wouldn't come back to this anything in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the problem that some tracks do have, is the naysayer.
Yep.
I mean, I ended up going to a banquet the other night in Boise, Idaho on Saturday night. Had 650 people at a weekly banquet. And the positive energy that came out of that banquet is unbelievable. I could tell that it was, they're an ASA member track, and I could just tell over the last 3 years that they've helped benefit from not only the sport itself, but having, you know, having us to ask questions and having us help contribute to their, like, their A and B scoring system and their point funds and the rest of it. So, to me, it's all kind of circular. I mean, everybody is, they got a right to say what they want to say, but I still think that that we can either make or break our own sport.
Dennis, can we have you back in before Daytona?
Sure.
Cool. We really...
it seems like we've just scratched the surface. We've been on. We've been going on for 45 minutes here, and it's unreal.
And I will apologize to you.
No, that's great. It's great.
Yeah, we would love to have you come back, and because now I've got... I'll send you a new list. How's that?
Okay. That sounds good.
Dennis Huth with the ASA, man. Thank you very much.
Real quick, Dennis, before we go, sounds to me like you're raising another kid.
Do what now? I'm sorry.
Sounds to me like you're raising another kid.
You know, I feel like it, and I feel happy about it because the passion is still there. And in looking, you know, it's the people that we deal with. That's the important part.
Right.
And I enjoy what I do. You guys sound like you enjoy what you do immensely, too. And, you know, keep up the good work because I know that you're a positive nature, and I think that if we can continue on. In fact, the one real quick thing before I leave, somebody called me from one of the major racing papers yesterday and said, well, what do you think about the ASA, about the late models throughout the country? We're here, they're kind of, and I said, whoa, stop right there. I think you're totally wrong. Because what I'm seeing, like in our super late model stuff that we've got out there right now, especially in the Southeast, I'm seeing a resurgence taking place.
Absolutely. No doubt about it.
So I've tried to stop them in the tracks, and, you know, I think we all want to do that because we love to see a good race, we love to see good entertainment, and there's good people out there.
Happy Thanksgiving, Dennis.
Happy Thanksgiving,
we'll talk
Dennis.
To you soon, man.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dennis.
Uh-huh.
What an interview. That was awesome. Jack, you want to take a quick break here?
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
All right, we'll take a quick break. Real Racing USA, Dennis Huth, owner of the ASA, and like I said, the guru / godfather of the Craftsman Truck Series. We'll be right back.
Today we salute you, Mr. Fantasy Football Manager Guy.
Mr. Fantasy Football Manager Guy.
Every year you assemble your closest friends to prepare for another season in the knockdown, drag-out world of make-believe football.
4th and inches.
You were born with the one skill every manager needs to play fantasy football. Absolutely no skill playing real football.
Not so good at catching.
Imaginary catches. Imaginary touchdowns. Next up, an imaginary score with an imaginary woman.
Good imagination.
So crack open a nice cold Bud Light, Swami of the sidelines. You may come in dead last, but you're always first with us.
Mr. Fantasy Football Manager Guy.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
When purchasing a technical product like brakes, there is no substitute for quality and experience. In the performance industry, no one has more experience than the Brakeman. The Brakeman has been designing high-performance solutions for a variety of applications for almost 40 years. The current products from the Brakeman are among the most advanced on the market. The Tornado calipers are the only calipers in the performance industry to carry a U.S. patent number and their new line of pads and rotors. The Brakeman Super Brakes are solving brake problems on hard-use vehicles, from police cars to ambulances and a variety of fleet vehicles. So if you're towing a trailer, carrying heavy loads, or just plain want to extend the life and stopping power of your vehicle, it's time to call the Brakeman on the web at thebrakeman.com.
This is Joe Irwin.
And this is Wayne Jefferson.
From Jefferson Irwin Racing.
And you're listening to Real Racing USA.
Carnac.com, your online racing community since 1997. Carnac.com is racing classifieds, racing photos, racing news, lively racing, message boards, chat rooms, multimedia, and so much more. And if your race team or racing business needs a website, or your website needs a fire lit under it, look no further than Carnac.com. From affordable web hosting to fancy flash animation, Carnac gets it done.
Are you ready to win? If so, it's time to move up to 5-Star Race Car Bodies. 5-Star Race Car Bodies designs and manufactures the highest quality race car body components. Short tracks, drag strips, road courses, and even in the desert, 5-Star has one driving passion: to help you win. 5-Star Race Bodies designs and manufactures for NASCAR, Grand Am, NHRA, IHRA, SCCA, short track asphalt, short track dirt, USAC, USAR, Hooters Pro Cup, and the ASA Late Model Series. Find out more today. 5starbodies.com.
Real Racing USA Live back on the airwaves.
It's officials night here at Real Racing USA Live, isn't it?
It's definitely officials night, and we've got the man who wrote the book on tech, Fritz Augustine. Fritz, welcome to Real Racing USA Live.
Well, thank you, sir.
It is an absolute honor to talk to you, Fritz. I mean, you've been in this business 49 years. They call you the top cop. They call you Pops. Tell us how it all started for you.
Well, I wish I really knew. I'm not sure. Back in the late 50s, I decided I was going to be the world's greatest race car driver. So I went out and built me up a car that I guess now you'd call it a street stock. And there was only two things that kept me out of that. One is I had no talent, and the other I had a bad temper. If it wouldn't have been for that, well, you'd have read about me.
Well,
just been doing it ever since. I've done it overseas. I've been very fortunate everywhere I was at. My commanding officers and the bases have always been lenient enough to let me take the time off necessary to pursue racing.
Well, you know, Fritz, I got to tell you, Skip Wall, and you know Skip, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, Skip wrote a story about you that we ran it on our website. And, of course, we get all kinds of people reading it, and some of your relatives started sending Skip mail telling him that you were in the Navy, not the Marines.
Yeah, I was going to mention that to Skip, because some of my Navy buddies have gotten some mileage out of this already.
Oh, I bet they have.
Uh-huh.
So you retired now at the end of the year here in the Pro Cup. The last race was your last deal in the...
Yes, sir, that was it.
Yeah. So, what are some of the highlights? I mean, I'm sure you know that's a big deal. That's a big step, obviously. And what are some of the highlights that you've thought about recently?
I think the best thing that ever happened to me in racing, I plugged along at various racetracks, did various things for various promoters, did whatever it took to everything from selling popcorn to cleaning toilets, and along came a man named Bob Harmon, who we all know and love. And Bob called one day and said, we're going to start a series, and this is what it's going to be, and I need a tech man. And I said, well, I don't think I'd like to be a tech man. I have never thought too much of him, and I don't think I want to be one. And he says, well, come on up here and let's talk. We didn't start talking to him, and he had a whole different viewpoint on racing than I had been accustomed to. He was there. Before that, it was us again you. It was the racers again the officials. And there was almost always a fight. You might not be in it, but you can bet there's going to be one there. And Bob said, we're not going to do that. This race, we're going to clean this racing up, make it a family sport, and make it fun for everybody. And I said, well, I'd like to think I can help. And the very next year, we started the All-Pro Series with the four exhibition races. And then the second year, we came out with a full-fledged schedule. And It took off from there. Ran good, and Bob was good to work for. He was a little strict once in a while, a little tough once in a while, but he was awfully, awfully fair.
So you were like right there in the founding of that series.
The day that he, Neil Bonnet, and Frankie Grill, and David Pearson sat down in Prattville, Alabama, to find out if this series would work, they had invited me up there, and I've been there. I was there for till All Pro closed. Not closed, but sold to NASCAR, and they took it.
Yeah.
That's saying something about a series when NASCAR wants it.
Yeah, we got kind of lucky. Everything went pretty good. I always had the best job of all because the flagman and the promoter and the race director and all them, they never get a chance to really get down there and rub elbows with the people that are putting on the show. And I kind of figured I was lucky getting down in amongst them.
Now, you know, I've heard a lot of stories about you, Fritz, but the thing that stands out the most is it seemed like you just had a knack for when people were pushing the line.
Well, you got to remember what pushing the line really is. You do it. I do it. I drove down the highway today. I don't know how many cops are listening, but I drove faster than 70. Now, I've done a lot of things like that. I was a kid that pushed the envelope pretty hard when I was growing up. And I wouldn't give you 15 cents for a carload of drivers that came trying to run second. And nobody calls you and asks you, what is second place pay? They call in about the Snowball Derby now, want to know if I'm going to be back down there. There's like 60 some cars signed up for the Derby and 75 signed up for the Snowflake. And they all want to know, what does it pay to win? Nobody's asked me yet what it pays to run second. So I guess there nobody's going to run second.
Yeah, I was at a racetrack earlier this year where a modified driver, had been racing forever in Florida. Mm-hmm. He was making that kind of point, what you just made. He was trying to talk the promoter into paying the most money, paying more for running second than for first.
Yep.
So do you think your background gave you the knack to know when somebody was soaking a tire? Or?
It had to.
Yeah.
It had to. I otherwise I'd have stuck this out of the ground. I was lucky when I retired from the Navy. I had time, I had the funds, I had a retirement check, and a wife that had a fantastic job. So I went back to college. Bob Harmon told me when I retired, he says, you need to get a little more of the technical expertise of this. So I went back to college and finished my engineering degree, and it really helped me in racing.
Well, one of the things that I've asked this question many times is, you know, like at the local tracks, you go, people are always, you know, of course, griping about the flag man or the tech man, or sure, they don't know this or they don't know that. And a lot of times, maybe there's some merit there, you know, because the guys don't know. Like, there's no place to go. There's no school you go to learn to be a flagman, or no school you go to learn to be a tech man. And then I was talking to some folks up at New Smyrna, I guess your friend Mark. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you actually put a school together and had a booklet that you put together, and you still do? You still update it?
Yeah. I started that in 98. And we started it I started before that handing out brochures, and I did it on the Internet through a thing I called CASO, which was Competition Auto Speed Sports Official. And I got took over by drag racing and stuff that I didn't know anything about. And it just ate me up. I didn't know anything about it, and I couldn't help them. So I decided I better find me something that I can do. I'll stick with stock cars. And we'll go from there and try to put something together. So I guess in 97 was the first year that I had it. And I thought, well, I'll try it. And this was not my idea, by the way. This was my wife and Bob Harmon. Hmm. Decided that's what I ought to do. And I did. I wrote it. And I thought, well, let's see if anybody buy it. And surprisingly enough, a lot of promoters jumped on it. And I made it worth their while. They pay me expenses and $20 $20 for each official they send in there, and I furnish the book.
Yeah,
sounds pretty reasonable.
We tried to get it set up because a lot of guys really didn't know. They wanted to know. They wanted to do a good job. I think every inspector would like to do a good job.
Sure.
Just some of them have to bluff their way through because they don't know, and some of them have to honestly say they don't know. And the racer finds out that you don't know a particular thing, you can bet he's going to use it.
Well, speaking of something on that subject, what about this subject of traction control?
Okay, what about it?
What do you know about traction control?
Well, I wrote a paper for an organization, and they sent it out to all of their tracks on the 9 traction controls I know of and how to catch them.
Really?
Can you tell by watching a car on the track, basically, if it's got traction control?
It depends on what traction control is on the car.
Okay.
The really, really good one? No. Nope, I can't.
No?
Now, I can take what I did was I went and bought an old military surplus tape recorder, a 2-channel tape recorder. And I put 1,000 cycle tone on one channel and put the noise out of the exhaust on the other. And if I set that up and watch it, I can tell you when the traction control cuts in and cuts out.
There's nine basic traction controls out there?
Well, now that's all I know. There may be 400.
Right, right. That's the way I've heard it.
The nine that I know of, yeah.
Now, Fritz, you've had to probably just about seen it all. What's some of the more unique things people have tried to slide by you?
The most unique thing I ever saw in my life, I went over and congratulated the driver and the car owner, shook his hand and hugged that boy's neck. We were in Nashville, Tennessee, and a young man came in there, and he set the world on fire. He was three-quarters of a second. I had All-Pro. He was three-quarters of a second faster than anybody else. And when you've got people like Butch Lindley and Gary Ballou and these Dick Andersons and them boys out there, and somebody turns three-quarters of a second faster than they got, he's doing something wrong. Whether or not you catch it, I don't know. But he's doing something. And we went to look at it. And couldn't find it until I got under the car and was just generally looking, and I didn't know what I was looking for. But between this man's exhaust pipe and the frame was a little piece of braided hosing, about an inch long between them. And what he had done, he had gone inside there and took a 4-inch by 4-inch piece of channel, put it from the right front to the left rear of the car, and Teflon'd it on the inside. And then took his lead and Teflon'd it, greased it. And what he would do, the crew chief would walk up to the side of the car before when he cranked it up, put his leg again in the exhaust. It would create pressure. It would put pressure down that little braided hosing against the Teflon and shove that thing clear to the left rear corner of the car. And the driver would put a pin in the little hole. And there's a big soft spring behind that lid. After the race is over, he just pulls the pin. And the vibration and that soft spring puts the lead back up to the right front corner.
Amazing.
That's just downright cheating.
No, that's not cheating. That's smart.
Okay.
There is a very definite difference. He got away with something, and they took the guys up there, they said, "We know he's got something." I said, "Well, no kidding, you don't wreck it." And we started looking, and it took me the better part of an hour to find it. And with 65 to 70 cars there, you don't have the better part of an hour to spend on each car.
Right.
But we found it, and I had him park the car, and we chained it up so he couldn't use it. And I went over to him and told him, I said, "I'd like to talk to you. Who designed that?" He said, "Well, we kind of did." And I said, "Well, I'd like to shake your hand." And we shook his hand, shook the owner's hand, and they sent him on their way.
Can you say who that was? Okay.
He's a friend of mine now.
Oh, okay.
Well, he was a friend that day, too. It's just that we were on the opposite side of the fence.
Right, right. And you were just doing your job.
That's all you're doing. And as long as racers realize you're just doing your job, and they're just doing theirs, a crew chief that doesn't stretch the rules right as far as the tech man let him, he's not helping his driver as much as he can.
What do you think about the kids? Obviously, you're aware. I mean, we have so many. We have what we call the youth movement in full swing.
Uh-huh. Well, I would have said 2 or 3 or 4 years ago that, no, they're a flash in the pan. Don't worry about it. But when you look around at some of these boys now, some of these kids, as I'll call them, they are real race car drivers. They've got their stuff together. Now, I talked to a couple of them off and on, and I talked to one real closely down in Lakeland the other night. And he's not just a race car driver, and he's not just a 16-year-old kid. He knows some stuff about race cars. He knows some stuff about setups. He knows some stuff about engines. He's a knowledgeable young man for being 16 years old. He's amazing.
Right. Yeah, you have to have seen a few of those, more than a few of those in the recent years in the Pro Cup. I mean, they've had some.
You look at, and I'm going to call him a kid like Joey Clanton.
Sure.
Or you look at Joey, what's his name? Going in Bush, he's in Bush now. Anyhow.
Logano.
That's it, Logano.
Yeah.
He come out and raced us halfway through the season, he turned 15. About 3 races later, we was up in Salem, Indiana. I don't know if you're familiar with that racetrack, but that is a fast, fast, yep, Sure. The first racetrack. And if you don't stay right up against that wall, you're not going to run with the boys, the big boys. Joey put that thing up there and won the race at 15 years old, like his third Hooters race.
Mm-hmm.
And he won it. And, of course, we couldn't give him champagne. There's a lot of things. The kids are coming along. They've got more experience, though. Seems like back 15 years ago, when a kid come in, he had maybe 1, maybe 2 years experience at best. Some of these boys have been driving go-karts, and there are stepping stone series for these boys now.
Right.
They can go out here, and one of the best series that I know of is that Allison Legacy series.
Mm-hmm.
They get real race cars. Those cars are, they can be sat up and everything else, and there's just tons of these. The boys are getting a lot of good education, a lot of good experience, and a lot of laps.
Right, and you know, like you said, at 16 years old, Jack said it earlier, a lot of these kids are almost grizzled veterans by now.
That's right. Mm-hmm. They're just terrible. They're good.
Yep.
And it's fun to work with them. It's really, really fun to work with them. Now, it's also fun to work with the old grizzly bears.
Right.
Like Bobby Gill.
Bobby Gill's a very good example. Bobby Gill and I go way back. First time he left home, so to speak, he went for Bob Harmon's Keep It Simple Kiss Series, they called it. And it was Keep It Simple Stupid. The race cars were a very simple race car, and Bobby came to Pensacola. It was the first Kiss race. He came up there and won it. And then he won one over at Mobile. And that was the first time he had ventured out from his local racetracks down there.
Right.
I got to know him at that time, and I've really got to know him since then. And Bob is a tremendous person. He's one of those kind of guys that when he goes to the racetrack, he don't see nothing but that race car.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He absolutely sees 100% of the race car.
You walk through the deal, you know, when you're there pre-race doing your media stuff, and you know, I don't know about me, but when I go up near anywhere near Bobby Gill, I just like, okay, I'll go talk to one of these kids, you know. I don't even want to talk to this guy.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But
he's focused.
I went to a race years ago, and I wasn't working in Montgomery, Alabama, in the Southern All Stars race, and Bob wasn't racing, but he was there. And I walked over and sat down on the trailer and didn't expect too much of a conversation, of course. And, you know, we had a real nice conversation, talked about everything and nothing, just everything. He was just a nice, he's a good old boy.
Right.
The very next Saturday night, we were racing in Greenville Pickens, and Bob was running with us. I went over and said something to him. He said, yeah, is there anything else? I mean, like, that's the entire conversation.
Right.
But he has tunnel vision towards that car, and I think that's one of the reasons he's so successful is that
no
he
doubt.
Concentrates on.
Well, yeah, now, this year in the Pro Cup, what do you think was some of the big contributing factors of Bobby coming back and winning the thing with, you know, you got these development teams and, like, the young kids and tons of money, and, you know, how did Bobby do it?
Bob never races the racers until he's ready to race the racers. You watch Bob, he don't lead many laps up early. But he's there. He's waiting and he's looking. And from listening on his radio, he's working with stuff all the time. He's never satisfied with that car. Well, it might be a little bit better if we could do a little bit here, a little bit there. And when time comes to go, he goes. And as we saw the other night now, had a, not a rookie, but a second-year veteran pull up beside him at the last few laps and started to pressure him. And I said at the time, I said, oh, the boy's just about to go to school. And sure enough, he went to school.
Yeah.
And I've watched him so many times, and he's just flat good.
He's always out there. He's always hanging around, and
uh-huh.
Yeah, he's always hanging around.
Yep.
Fritz, I gotta ask you. You've been a tech man for a long time. Has there ever been that point where you watched a hell of a race go down and close at the end, and you get the guys in tech and the guy won, and you look at the car and you see something, and it's right there on the edge? Have you ever had to think about whether to DQ him or not?
Yes, sir. Yep.
What kind of feelings go through you at that time?
It hurts. It hurts bad. Because this particular man was a good friend of mine. He didn't come back. He has not come back and raced yet.
Right.
He is a tremendous race car driver. Luckily, he has gone on to bigger and better things. But we had to DQ him, and it was one of the toughest jobs you have, is putting him out for something like that. Now, it was something that I honestly don't believe they did it with the intent of cheating, but it did enhance the performance of the vehicle, and it was beyond the rule. Right. So, you got to do it.
Yeah, and, you know, Fritz, you're basically the tech man is the deciding factor of that gray area, right?
Yes, sir.
Explain what the gray area is to people out there.
Okay. There are things that will make a difference, and there are things that won't make a difference. Now, I went to a racetrack once. In fact, I took my school to it. And this one young tech inspector looked at the rules, and he says, "Well, I see something here. Good, what do you see?" And he says, "Do you know how tall the letters are supposed to be on the car?" I says, "If you measure a man's numbers on his car and say one derogatory thing to him, the first thing you do is defend yourself, because I'm coming after you." Now, that is, to me, that's not even a gray area. That's one of those things. There are gray areas, yes. And you have to look at it just to see what it was. Now, we had a man one night put the left side tires on the right side and right side tires on the left side. Now, naturally, he went to the rear almost immediately. The car wouldn't handle it. It was a piece of junk. He brought it in, and I was there to see what was going on. I noticed the tires were on the wrong side. Now, technically, it said that those left side tires can't be used on the right and the right can't be used on the left. Technically, I could have disqualified him at that time and told him to park the car.
Right.
To me, that's a gray area. That's time for a little common sense.
It wasn't helping him.
I think common sense is the gray area.
Yeah.
And to be, besides having very broad shoulders, tech men really need that common sense factor.
Well, yeah, and they got to try to remember that those are the boys that are putting on the race out there. We aren't. Nobody comes to watch tech.
Right.
They come to watch that race. And it's just, it's a lot of fun. It's fun most of the time. There are harsh moments, but almost always, you'll get a man in the trailer and let him vamp. He's going to have some things to say, let's face it. He's just spent a week and a half laying under that car getting it just like he wants it, and you told him it's wrong.
Right.
So he's going to raise some cane. Let him vamp. Let him get all true and then tell him, "Look, I understand where you're coming from, but here's where it is. This is what the rule says. You and I both are going to go by these rules. I'm not going to make you weigh 50 pounds more than the rule book says. And you're not going to weigh 50 pounds less than the rule book says. Now, the book's here. The book's easy to understand. We've told you, and that's it. Now, I hate you don't like it, but we just don't agree."
Right.
And another thing I do after I have disqualified someone or they've had a bad night and had to talk about it, I go to his trailer. Go to his trailer. He don't leave that racetrack until he and I got it settled, we'd shake hands. And if it takes 2 hours, which it has, it just takes 2 hours.
Right.
And it's 2 hours well spent.
No doubt.
He's got to realize that I ain't Jesus. I'm just there doing a job. I'm doing the best I can do, and I may make a mistake. He better hope I'm right. He better hope I'm good enough.
Mm-hmm.
So you going to the Governor's or the Snowball Derby this year?
I don't know. I talked to Tim. I talked to Timmy Bryant down this promoter.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I talked to him, and I'd like to go down. He says you don't need any help, he doesn't think, but he'd like to have me around.
Of course.
Yeah, we talked to him last week.
To cover those gray areas.
we talked to him last week, and he said something when we asked him about you. I can't remember what. Rick, can you remember?
I can't remember.
He had some funny thing he said. I can't remember it either. But, yeah, that's got to be something you look forward to every year, huh?
It is. Well, you know, I lived there in Pensacola for 35 years.
Sure.
And that was the thing you look forward to. And the thing is, you go somewhere else. You go to Milwaukee. You talk to a racer in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll say, oh, you're from Pensacola. Snowball Derby, right? That's a big deal. I mean, that's a big deal all over the country.
It's a very big deal.
And now the All-American 400 has grown. So it's a pretty good size race. And, yeah, I'll probably be over there.
Yeah, you just look at the entries. Man, it's you better bring your good stuff to that race, man.
Well, you know, I was just looking at the Snowflake entry.
Mm-hmm.
And the Snowflake itself had got enough good drivers in it that could win it.
Sure.
There's probably 15, 20 in there that I can look at right now and tell you they've got a good chance of taking the money home.
Yeah.
And that's the good thing. That we've been very fortunate in the Hooters Pro Cup. We've been able to keep it level playing enough that any time you go to the racetrack, there's six or eight guys to win that race.
Always. Very competitive. Very competitive.
Always has been, too.
And you look at the qualifying times, and the qualifying times are going to be, the top 20 are going to be within a quarter of a second easily.
Sure.
I've been to several Pro Cup races where the top five break the track record.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Fritz, after 49 years, what are you going to miss the most?
The racers.
The drivers and the racers themselves?
Yeah. The drivers, the crew chiefs. You can only wrestle a man so many years until you get to know him.
Right.
And I think I wrestle about each one of them at least once. it's something. I'm going to miss it. You bet your life I'm going to miss it. But I've had an advantage in that Gene Cox and Tony have given us extremely good backing. If I said something was green, they just got the paint out and started painting it. They backed me 100%. They got Daniel Schmidt. I think you know him now.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel's helped me for 15, 16 years. And he's going to step in there. And he's going to do a good job. And honestly, I believe he'll do as good a job as I could have done. I think he'll take on right where I was at.
Yeah, but I bet he hears a few, well, Fritz would have done. Well, yeah. Fritz would have said.
They call him Little Fritz and all that. And he says, thank you very much, and keeps walking. And Daniel and I not only are fellow tech officials, we're very good friends.
So,
I know his family real well. I love his wife and daughter, and just, you know, we're good friends.
Well, Fritz, I know you ain't going to be sitting around watching soap operas on TV or reruns. What are you going to be doing here? You going to write a book now?
I've got one started.
Good for you. Good for you. That's cool.
I'm also updating the Tech Inspector's technical seminar book.
Yep.
The textbook, as I call it. I'm updating it a little bit. There's some things happened this last couple of years that's not in the 2005 edition. And, yeah, I've got a book started. And I'm pretty close to Lake City.
Right.
And there's a racetrack at Lake City.
There's two of them.
And I just might drop down there on a weekend and see those boys.
Well, you can start giving Don Rone some advice up there.
Don and I, that's kind of funny because Don was the headed up our Hooters series when we first started it.
Right.
And we had the formula cars, and the late models, and the sportsman cars. We had every kind of a car you could think of. And Don and I were together at that time. Yeah. Oh, he knows I'm coming back. He knows I'm going to be around. yeah, I'll probably give him a little grief.
Well, you know, 49 years in racing, I mean, what a career, you know.
It would have been 50, but I had to take a year off to take a vacation in Southeast Asia for a year.
Oh, did you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting. You know, the respect that you've got from the drivers, the crews, so many tech guys, you know, they just don't seem to get it to how to do that.
They're too important. They're honestly too important. If they really realize what they're there for, we are the least important people at the racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
We work about 6 minutes a day. We measure some cars and we check, make sure they're high enough and all. But we work about 6 minutes a day. After they get the head torn off and everything else, you can check it in about 6 minutes. And anybody who thinks he's important should not become a tech inspector because he's not going to be important.
Right. Exactly.
And it's a shame. I would have liked to have been somebody big, but it just don't work that way. You're a tech inspector and that's all you are, and you got to get used to that.
Yeah, well, you know what? Out of all the tech inspectors in Florida, in the world, you're probably the most well-known.
Well, I don't know about that, but I sure
can. You name another one?
I sure made a lot of friends.
Who are some of the people in the business that do what you do that you hold in high regard?
A man that used to work for Tom Curley named Stan Meserve. He's Earnhardt's plate man now. It works on setup for Earnhardt.
Uh-huh.
And he ran the ACT series, and I had the opportunity to work for him at one of the, what do they call it, Stock Car Connection. The Stock Car Connection races when ASA and ACT and All-Pro all went, and NASCAR all went together and put on a show. They put on a show up in Canada, put one on down in Nashville, and they were big shows now because they bring the big guns in. Stan Meserve was the tech man. So I had a chance to work with him, and I've got to know him since then. And Stan, he stands off the tall, my book.
Well, that's awesome. How do I want to put this? What race in your 49 years stands out the most to you?
Well, there's two.
Two?
Yeah. One was a race in Birmingham. Was a Hooters race.
Uh-huh.
When the end of the race came, we had four or five cars within a half second of each other. They were just one big wad of cars.
Uh-huh.
In the center of Birmingham racetrack used to be a football field. I would stand out there in line with start-finish line so I could help look and see who won the race.
Uh-huh.
And I stood there screaming and cheering, and to this moment, don't know who I was cheering for.
It was just that good.
It was so good, I just was screaming my butt off. I wanted somebody to win that. Sure enough, they did. Marty Lindley wound up winning it.
Uh-huh.
But I was just screaming. And the other one would have been the worst race I've ever had in my entire life, was the night we hurt Butch Lindley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a sad one right there.
Yeah.
He was as good a race car driver as I've ever known.
Mm-hmm.
He could make a race car do things that the race car can't do.
Wasn't supposed to do anyway.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. He's that good.
I tell you, one of my most memorable races is the Hooters Pro Cup race when Derek Kelly came back from two laps down at Lakeland.
That side-by-side finish there?
No.
Huh?
Wow. Now, photo finish.
Derek got out of that car and tired, he couldn't see straight.
Right.
He had flat carried that machine for the last 50 laps.
And Fritz, we're going to be talking here in a few minutes with Joe Schmalling.
Who's
he's with that new deal doing the Super Cups. And he said that you had told him that if you retired that, he could call you on you anytime. And he said, expect to see a draft notice in the mail.
Well, I've got Joe on my speed dial.
Okay.
Joe and Kathleen are super people, and he'll do a good job there. He'll do a tremendous job for us.
So where do you see it all going? How do you see this whole, especially the big guns, where do you see this kind of racing going?
Well, honestly, there's a big influx of cars coming in. There's 750 cars going to become available, or they came available this last weekend.
Right.
750. And that's awesome. That's scary.
Isn't it, though?
Now, when we started our series that we have now, we were more or less took over the NASCAR sportsman cars that they had stopped. They stopped running them, and we picked them up. Now, somebody is waiting out there in the wings, and I don't know who it is, but there's somebody sitting out there in the wings right now. Says, my God, there's 750 race cars sitting there ready to drive. They should be out making noise somewhere.
And there's plenty of drivers ready to go drive them.
Ready to get in them.
And I can't tell you who's going to do it, but I will be one of the most surprised people in town if somebody don't get it to do it.
Yeah, they're not going to take them and put them out in the desert with the jet planes to sit. Yes, that's for sure. Yeah.
These things are going to make noise in April or May.
Yeah, and there's too many of them to make a museum out of them.
Oh, yeah. it's going to be fun to watch. And somebody says, well, ARCA's going to have a lot of cars. ARCA can't use 750.
No.
Exactly.
I mean, they can use 100, 100 and a quarter, probably.
Uh-huh.
But the other 600?
They got to go somewhere.
Race cars that are good race cars. Those, by the time you get to Nextel Cup, you've got a jam-up race car.
Uh-huh.
I can't see it sitting there.
I'll tell you, Fritz, my wish is that they get them and they stick them on some short tracks.
Oh, yes.
And keep them there.
Well, we're going to run this. I say we. I keep saying that, but I'm not part of it anymore. The Hooters is going to run at Milwaukee this next year.
Right.
And then, of course, they run Lakeland. We're going to run Bristol. And they're going to run Rockingham.
Right.
That's a big one.
That's a one-mile track.
Yeah.
To me, that's as big a track as we better get on.
Yep.
I would rather see on three-quarter and smaller. I love a half-mile to 5/8 racetrack, like Lakeland, for example.
Uh-huh. Yep.
You can put on a tremendous show there.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And a driver can showcase his abilities. They can showcase the car. And we get a pretty good race out of it for the fans. And anytime you can get a good crowd of cars and a good crowd in the stands at the same time, you win.
Yeah, you know, I think Kenny Wallace said it best. Hooters Pro Cup will always survive as long as they don't outgrow themselves.
That's the thing right there.
Yep.
See, we have to be careful. Again, I say we, and I shouldn't be doing that.
You'll always be we.
Probably. But they are going to have to make sure that they don't outgrow themselves. Don't become too important in your own mind. They'll be doing great.
All right, Fritz. I'm sure that I can see it now. We're going to be talking to you again.
Oh, no doubt.
I imagine before, what, March? Yeah. Something's going to happen, and we're going to ring your bell, man.
Yeah. We might be calling him after the Snowball Derby.
Yeah, could you ever know. Appreciate you spending some time here with us tonight. And
we have.
Best of luck on everything, and I can't wait for that book to come out.
Yeah.
Well, there's no beeper on a book, so I'm going to have to take care of a couple.
There you go, man.
Yeah, you need to have an edited version and an unedited version.
That's what this guy that's helping write it told me.
One for the pits, one for the grandstands.
Uh-huh.
There you go. All right, Fritz, we'll talk to you soon.
Happy Thanksgiving, Fritz.
Thank you, sir. You too. Y'all take care, and good job.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Fritz Augustine.
Now, where do you get back-to-back interviews like that?
Man, Real Racing USA. It is break time. We're coming back with Troy DeCare, who's waiting anxiously to talk to us, and Joe Schmalling, and we'll see what, if he's got the draft sent off to Fritz yet.
All right.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Discount Airline Pilot Guy.
Mr. Discount Airline Pilot Guy.
Your minimal experience flying a plane will never land you at a reputable airline. Luckily, you don't work for one.
Look at me, I'm flying.
Sure, we're concerned for our lives. Just not as concerned as saving $9 on a round trip to Fort Myers.
Oh!
The most direct route to Houston? Through Fort Lauderdale, with layovers in Detroit, Vancouver, and Kalamazoo.
I can't feel my legs.
So crack open a nice cold Bud Light, oh, skipper of the skies. You put the fly in fly-by-night operation.
Mr. Discount Airline Pilot Guy.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
When purchasing a technical product like brakes, there is no substitute for quality and experience. In the performance industry, no one has more experience than the brakeman. The brakeman has been designing high-performance solutions for a variety of applications for almost 40 years. The current products from the brakeman are among the most advanced on the market. The Tornado calipers are the only calipers in the performance industry to carry a U.S. patent number and their new line of pads and rotors. The Brakeman Super Brakes are solving brake problems on hard-use vehicles, from police cars to ambulances and a variety of fleet vehicles. So if you're towing a trailer, carrying heavy loads, or just plain want to extend the life and stopping power of your vehicle, it's time to call the Brakeman on the web at thebrakeman.com.
This is Joe Irwin.
And this is Wayne Jefferson.
From Jefferson Irwin Racing.
And you're listening to Real Racing USA.
Carnac.com, your online racing community since 1997. Carnac.com is racing classifieds, racing photos, racing news, lively racing, message boards, chat rooms, multimedia, and so much more. And if your race team or racing business needs a website, or your website needs a fire lit under it, look no further than Carnac.com. From affordable web hosting to fancy flash animation, Carnac gets it done.
Well, Jack, we're back, Real Racing USA Live. And, you know, after talking to Fritz there, and the time it is, looks like we're going to hit the gray area tonight.
Yeah, we're going to hit the gray area, no doubt.
And with us right now, the 2007 TBRA champion, Troy DeCare. Troy, welcome to Real Racing USA Live.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Troy, what a season you had this year, man. 2007 champion, wins all over the place. It just had to be a dream season for you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, coming into this series just a couple years ago, I never thought I'd be winning races like we are. Much less sitting here as the champion. It's definitely beside myself.
Now, you started out the season strong. What kept this team going all year long?
It's pretty simple. George Rudolph, I mean, he puts together flawless equipment. I mean, anybody who's ever driven his car could tell you. We had one DNF, I believe, this year, and it was because we broke a shock. It wasn't really mechanical. We just got in there and bent up a shock, and that was it. We blew a motor one time. Excuse me, I'm sorry. But, I mean, you drive his car, and you can get in it, and you can tighten your belts with confidence. You know, it's going to make 35 laps as long as you can hang on to it.
Now, what was it like at DeSoto with that 50 lapper?
Oh, actually, that's where my shock went out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we had a real strong car. I went to the front fairly early. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to run, like, some USCS where I got to run, you know, 40, 50 lap races. And I ran the 500 and the 400, the Florida 400, and the little 500 up against Canada. So I got to run quite a few races with some extended laps. So, It wasn't that bad, but you put a wing on it, and it'll definitely wear you out a little bit. But it was pretty exciting. I mean, we had a full field of cars, and unfortunately, like, I had a shock issue, but it was definitely exciting race. And I'd like to run some more races like that with some extended laps, especially now that we finally got to a point where I'm starting towards the back most of the time. We're having a high point average and whatnot, you know.
Now, Troy, your dad's had extensive racing on the dirt. You ever thought about swapping over to dirt at all?
I've always wanted to run dirt. That's actually where I'd have to say where my heart is. But I grew up racing dirt go-karts, and I've made about four or five dirt starts in a sprint car. And you know, I'm trying to get some things going next year to run some more dirt races. And like I said, being that's where I came from, especially growing up out at East Bay watching my dad, I definitely love to do more dirt. Now pavement's where my primary ride is, and pavement essentially is the place, you know, I've had some people in my career tell me, you know, Daytona's pavement, Indianapolis is pavement, and if you're wanting to further your career, that's what you need to do. But dirt's definitely a lot better racing, and I'd like to, like I said, get some more time on there, but we'll have to see where that goes in the future.
Dirt racing, I mean, it's just it's a world of its own out there, slinging that car sideways and stuff. But watching you guys at, like, DeSoto and New Smyrna, the bigger tracks, those cars just unbelievable. It's like the top fuel of stock car racing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my favorite track, when I first got into it, I probably wouldn't have said this, but my favorite track now is definitely New Smyrna. I believe we won two or three times there this year. And, you know, tracks like that where you can really just let the car air out because, you know, contrary to what most people believe with the pavement car, the more you're on the gas and the more you drive, harder you drive that car, the easier it is to drive. And, you know, from the fan standpoint, you know, we're crazy people that strap into these things. But
yeah, I'll agree with that.
But from a driver's standpoint, you know, your New Smyrnas, your Lake Cities, your Pensacola, tracks like that, I definitely have to say now that I'm in definitely a quality ride that I lean towards more towards those tracks as opposed to, you know, some of the smaller tracks, which are still fun, but it's still those, you know, everybody being so equal in speed in our series that it, you know, it's tough. You got to sometimes get in there and mix it up when you don't really want to, you know.
Is the setup a lot different from a track like a smooth new surface of New Smyrna to the abrasive surface of, say, Pensacola?
Not really. Well, what I found out, especially because this is there's different rules, and obviously the USCS says there is the TBRA, and TBRA doesn't go to Pensacola, but USCS does, so there's some different changes you make there as far as your offset rules to your wheels. But, I found out with our car, coming from Stan Butler's team and Butler Motorsports and them guys, what we were doing over there, we were trying too hard, it seemed like, and now I'm with George, it's fairly basic, and once you get what the driver likes and what the car likes, from track to track, we really don't change a whole lot as opposed to the other cars. Now, with a non-wing, that's definitely a different story, but I tell you right now, on our car, we didn't change the springs or the shocks maybe once or twice the whole season. We stayed pretty much at our base setup, and we just, you know, made some weight different changes, but like I said, the car stays pretty neutral throughout track to track with our style cars, with a wing anyway.
Even Ocala?
That Ocala is where you're making your spring change. And actually what we do there, all we really do is we cross the front springs and make a few other little stagger adjustments. I mean, like, for the most part, our biggest deal every week is trying to get our stagger right. We get our stagger right, and the car usually does exactly what I want it to. Because, like I said, George, you know, he's very, you know, on top of the car as far as maintenance goes, and that's the biggest thing. And but the car setup is very basic, and everybody out there trying to reinvent the wheel, so to speak, and we like to just keep it basic and hit the tires. I think the tires is probably the most important thing in our series.
Go ahead, Rick.
When you hit that plane with a race car, that's got to be the most comfortable moment ever.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, We come out the box this year, and we had, I think, four wins or so right off the, you know, in the first half of the season, and like six or seven top three finishes, and we were in the hunt. I think I led a lap in every race there for like the first eight races or something, and, you know, just or whatever the case was, and I was in very comfortable situation with our race car, and we had a point where George, whatever he was doing, was liking whatever I was doing in the car, and then halfway through the season, George builds a brand new race car and swaps cars on me, and fortunately went right back to winning because that's just the type of car owner George is. But I was so happy with the other car, and I was so comfortable, and like the new car was far more superior as far as, you know, up to date equipment, a better engine, and stuff like that. But like you said, when you hit that sweet spot with that car, it was definitely hard to peel me out of that seat and put me in the new car, even though the new car, like I said, was much better.
What was it like? There was a lot of tire issues at first at New Smyrna. What was it like going out on that new pavement?
Well, we got out there, and it was so it almost felt like a really tacky dirt track. I mean, you could go from the top to the bottom, and it was going to wear your tires out. It was like a Pensacola. you know, Pensacola, you can run flat out for probably four or five laps if you really want to, not lift, but you're not going to have a right rear tire left.
Right.
And that was the case with New Smyrna. And, you know, I went out there, and I won the heat race, and we came in and looked at the tire, and I went around looking at everybody else's tires, and our tire stayed pretty good. And that's usually when you can tell when you have a good car, is when your left rear and your right rear, that air pressure comes in, and they're about the same, and, you know, they're not, the right rear is usually a lot hotter than the left rear, but if you can keep them pretty neutral, you got a good balance going. And they actually gave us the option for everybody to put a new right rear tire on, and I was fine with that, but I was hoping we'd leave the old tires on, because it appeared that everybody else was burning their tires up, and luckily I got out of there and ended up winning the race anyways. But definitely before that track got seated in, it was definitely eating some tires up on these race cars, especially with the wing, like we got really, really cranking down on that right rear.
Well, Troy, you by winning this championship, I mean, you entered a pretty good club. I mean, your name's going to be on there with Dave Scarborough, Wayne Rudiman, Taylor Andrews, Sam Rodriguez, Joe Melnick. I mean, Dude Teat, Dave Steele. What's that like, man?
Well, I mean, I kind of just got goosebumps, believe it or not. And, I mean, I grew up stuck to the fence at East Bay catching tear-offs off Roland Johnson's helmet. And, like, you know, the sprint car guys have always been my heroes. I mean, obviously, you know, I grew up in a late model family, and I loved late models. But I'd say my biggest hero growing up was definitely Sam Rodriguez. And he's kind of been like a, you know, like an uncle to me. And he's definitely taken me under his wing growing up through the go-kart ranks, and him and my dad being really, really close friends. You know, I called him up, and I tried to get him out the last race. Unfortunately, he was busy with Erica in the cup deal. But, you know, to be in a, you know, like, that was an elite group. I mean, those guys were racing gods to me. To, you know, when they come walking through the pit gate and I saw Sam Rodriguez and guys like that, I was just, you know, I was beside myself. And now to even be considered on the same page as them, I will never myself consider, like, to be half the driver those guys were, but... like, for people to mention me somewhere around them is definitely a big boost for my confidence.
Well, guess what, man? When you go back to the tracks next year, there are going to be all kinds of kids and fans in the stands that look at you that way. Get used to it. You earned it. You deserve it.
Well, I appreciate it, man. It was definitely a huge deal for me and my family. I mean, my mom was just in tears when we finally clinched it, and it was just, like I said, it's just a dream come true, and it's a big deal for this whole area. And like, I'd like to, you know, I'd like to come back next year and hopefully I can repeat the deal. But if I never do it again, I definitely am glad I got this opportunity to fill what I call a dream season.
I got a question for you. Wing or non-wing?
I'm a non-wing guy. I have most of my success with a wing. I got three or four wins without a wing. And, you know, coming from the low budget ranks like I have myself, I prefer the non-wing, because you can definitely get away with a lot, you know, lesser equipment. You could, it puts it more on the driver, because I've been in the wing car, and I get out there and my car will be just a little bit off, and I'm watching Dave Steele and them guys disappear down the straightaway, and I'm going, there's nothing you can do about it. And not that there's really anything you can turn into Superman in a non-wing car, but like, there's a point in the non-wing car where setup only gets you so far, and it's up to the driver to really carry it the rest of the way. And that's where Dave Steele definitely, I feel, excels over the rest of the field when it comes to non-wing racing. And I hope to think, like, one day I could get to that point. But I think the non-wing, if you get out there and your car's a little bit off, you can hustle up a little bit, maybe elbows up, and get yourself a top five when maybe you had an eighth place car.
All about getting up on that wheel, huh?
Absolutely.
So let me ask you, you ran the little 500, you've run the 400, you got the 400 coming up. What are the preparations, how do the preparations differ from, say, a 35 lap TBRA race to one of these 400 or 500 lap races?
I'd like to say that that, you know, I get in the gym and I eat right and all that, but I don't really do none of those things. I think it's more of a mental deal. Because I got all in the gym and worked out and drank water for 2 months straight before the 500, and I crashed on lap 9. And I was like, man, that's horrible. So this year I went there with this, hey, man, I'm just happy to be here, and then we ended up 7th. So I was like, you know, and we finished third in the 400 last year. It's really maintenance on the car. A to Z, the car, bumper to bumper, check it out. Like, make sure, you know, you got a fresh set of brakes on there. Everything is right. And, you know, like being associated with George Rudolph, this really, really helped me as far as, like, when we went to the 400. Our car, I can say that I got in there, and I wasn't worried, like, oh, man, is this going to fail? Is this going to fail? I was able to go there with, hey, drive the car. And I, with confidence that, you know, when the checkered falls, this thing will still be running. And like it was with the 400 and like it was with the 500 this year. And I say preparation is all 100% in the shop and mental, you know, as far as the driver standpoint goes. But you got to be on top of your equipment. That's definitely the name of this game.
No doubt about it. And it looks like they're expecting a huge field for that 400 race.
Yeah, that's what I heard. At first it was looking a little bleak, and then that. Here as of late, I found out that maybe some more cars have entered, which is good news, and I hope that race really takes off because it's nice for sprint car racing to have a you know, profound race here in Florida, like the PRI show and hopefully the 400, and that'd be two nice races for local guys like myself to race against, like, the national-type competition.
Talk about a little bit about that PRI race coming up.
That's a huge deal, especially for guys like myself or in the GRA who are looking to, you know, maybe show those USAC guys that, hey, you know, we can race down here in Florida too, because I feel there's a lot of big sprint car talent in Florida that maybe doesn't really get a look. And with the trade show coming down and everybody who's anybody in sprint car racing being at Orlando for one night or two nights or whatever it is, you know, if you can make the race and run with those guys, that very well could be one of two things for like a local boy like myself. That could be, you know, that could be your shot to be seen, or, you know, that could be a chance for, you know, you take your car up to Indiana, to Anderson, those guys get to race on that track 3, 4, 5 times a year. Where they come to Orlando, that's what we get to race 3, 4, 5 times a year. And it's our chance for, you know, for them to invade our home turf and us to really, you know, get a fair shake at maybe running with the higher dollar teams just by having pure local knowledge, you know what I'm saying?
Equals that playing field a little bit.
Absolutely.
Well, Troy, fantastic visiting with you tonight. We'll be up there to see you at the PRI show and at the race. And enjoy that championship, brother, because you're in everybody's scope.
Absolutely, man. I really appreciate it. And real quick, I'd just like to make sure I could thank everyone. I'd like to thank you guys for having me on here. And the CBRA is a fantastic series. And I hope Lenny Puglio and my dad and Robert Stevenson and Bo Hotley can really take that club to the next level and you know, make it the pronounced club that I know it is. And George and Martha Rudolph, mainly for just letting me drive their race car, and my mom and dad for always supporting me throughout this. It's really meant a lot. And, you know, radio shows like yourself for helping us people down here in Florida really get our, you know, get our voice out.
Well, Troy, again, congratulations, man, and we'll see you at Orlando.
Absolutely, man. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, brother. Troy DeCare, man.
Yeah, oh boy.
Yeah.
That's quite an exclusive list there. And there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Tell you what, we got to go take a quick break. We're going to come back with Joe Schmalling and talk about the new series that is going to be racing around North Carolina. And
750 cars.
Well, you know, it's huge. And then we have a little Thanksgiving surprise.
All right.
I got a Thanksgiving surprise cooked up for you, Rick.
All right. Well, as we drift into the gray zone of Real Racing USA Live.
Of Real Racing USA.
This is Joe Irwin.
And this is Wayne Jefferson.
From Jefferson Irwin Racing.
And you're listening to Real Racing USA.
Parts ASA Fast Lane, only on Real Racing USA. Meet the racers of America's most exciting short track racing series every Wednesday night from 8 p.m. until 9 p.m. From the Milwaukee Mile to Bristol Motor Speedway, Five Flags in Nashville, the ASA is the racing series where young talent meets wily veterans in extreme short track competition. O'Reilly is America's auto parts store, and the ASA is America's premier late model series. O'Reilly Auto Parts ASA Fast Lane gets you close to the action and behind the scenes with the real stories from the drivers themselves. The O'Reilly O'Reilly ASA Fast Lane. Only on Real Racing USA. When purchasing a technical product like brakes, there is no substitute for quality and experience. In the performance industry, no one has more experience than the brakeman. The brakeman has been designing high-performance solutions for a variety of applications for almost 40 years. The current products from the brakeman are among the most advanced on the market. The Tornado calipers are the only calipers in the performance industry to carry a U.S. patent number and their new line of pads and rotors. The Brakeman Super Brakes are solving brake problems on hard-use vehicles, from police cars to ambulances and a variety of fleet vehicles. So if you're towing a trailer, carrying heavy loads, or just plain want to extend the life and stopping power of your vehicle, it's time to go The Brakeman. On the web at TheBrakeman.com.
Where does the time go?
I do not know.
Real Racing USA Live, and tonight we've talked to Dennis Huth, the creator of the Craftsman Truck Series. We've talked to the legendary Fritz Augustine. We talked to, TBRA champions, and now we're going to talk to Joe Schmalling, who's the competition director for the new Super Cup Series.
Super Cup Stock Car Series.
There you go. Welcome to the show, man. How you doing, Joe?
We're doing real good. It's thank you for having us on the show.
So tell us about the new series. Now we've you've run a couple of races and you got your kind of things some of the quirks ironed out, I'm sure, and now you're ready to go tackle 2008. Tell us about it.
What we're doing is putting a series together for the steel body Pro Cup cars that are no longer legal in that series. There's several of them. Probably 100 or so around the country, and the interest is overwhelming for doing this. One of my associates has been walking around for a year trying to put this together, and he brought the program to me and said, we need to get this done. So we put on two exhibition races, one at Hickory and one at the Tri-County Motor Speedway this year, just to see how it would turn out. It was absolutely excellent racing. The crowd loved it. We have now put up our website. The information is available at supercupstockcarseries.com and also on your website. We'd like to thank you for doing that. Your website is awesome on your message board.
Thanks, man. So where do you open the season next year?
We're going to open the season on March 8th at the Tri-County Motor Speedway in Hudson, North Carolina. We're going to close the series on October 25th at the same racetrack. We've got three races scheduled at Tri-County, like I said, March 8th, June 6th, and October 25th. Where all dates now are inked in on our website.
What and what is your role in the series?
Well, I'm just one of the series directors. There's five of us who have come together to put this this series together, and it's Martin Esbett, who is one of the drivers in the Pro Cup Series, number 92 car. He's a commercial business banker here in Asheville, North Carolina.
Deep Pro Cup roots, too.
Quite a history.
Yeah.
Mike Kurkowski, who is a car owner in the Pro Cup Series. Lonnie Rush Sr., who also is a Pro Cup car owner. And Joe Harrison, Jr., who is a car owner and driver in the Pro Cup Series. And they're all series directors. And we just, it's an all-volunteer effort at this point. So no one's being paid. Everyone's working hard. It's it's very exciting to us.
Yeah, we had Fritz Augustine on earlier tonight, and he is really pumped up about this.
Well, one thing I would like to say to you guys before we go too far along. Dennis Huth, Fritz Augustine, then I have to follow these guys. What are you doing?
Yeah, we don't make it easy, man. We don't make it easy.
You know, when your people, you know, Skip came to our race, we put him in the VIP suite. and I was telling Jack about that. And I, you know, he said, don't spoil him, but the VIP suite is a room with a wooden chair and a window. we didn't spoil Skip.
Skip felt right at home, I guarantee you.
But, you know, it's wonderful to have him come and, you know, to help us and report on it. And the information on your website, you know, our release is, it's just absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, well, he definitely wants to help, and that's what Skip Wall's all about, you know, and I'm sure you know that. He just really wants to help.
You know, I met him years ago. He was a spotter for Martin Nesbitt in the Pro Cup Series years back. And that's, I think, when I first met him. You know, I don't know if you know this, but my wife and I were officials with the Pro Cup Series for 8 years.
Oh, yeah, he mentioned that. You worked with – what was your role there?
I worked with Fritz and was one of the pit road officials during the race.
Right.
And, yeah, like my wife said, one of the lowly officials. But I worked on pit road with the Pro Cup Series. They said we helped develop that series. I'd like to think that, you know, we helped to get it going. And I, obviously we know Fritz did. But it was I wanted to work pit road just so I could be closer to the racetrack.
You know what, Jack?
I think
Joe is that guy that kept telling us to back up.
Probably. See, you know, that's the way we are. I get it. You know, when we go to racetracks to cover races all over, and you know, nowadays we travel North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, and you know, people always want us to come up into the tower. Not me, man. I could not watch a race from the tower. I don't care if I can't see the whole track. I would feel like I was missing something if I was not down in those pits during the race.
Well, the thing is, you know, like I said, what I liked about it is I could walk out to the edge of the racetrack at the start of the race, which to me was the best part of the race, that and, of course, the finish.
Yeah.
But, you know, and, you know, you could yell and you could cheer and no one could hear you because the cars were under full acceleration. That was the thrill for me.
Yep, you got it.
I got paid to do that.
That's cool.
Now, how timely is this series, Joe, now that Winston Cup is phasing out the Cup cars,
steel-body
cars?
Winston Cup?
And
I thought we were selling telephones now.
The Cup cars.
Okay.
Right. We had looked at doing those cars and using those cars, but and I've talked to several other promoters that, you know, had ideas for them. And like Fritz said, someone's going to do something with them. Our focus is on the steel-body Pro Cup cars.
Mm-hmm.
If someone wants to bring a Cup car and race in our series, they'll have to change a few things and meet the criteria of our series. So the Winston Cup or Nextel Cup cars, per se, just aren't legal in what we're doing.
Now, Hooters Pro Cup steel body car is what, 3,400 pounds?
3,300.
I got you, okay.
And what it is they look like a stock car. They don't look like a late model car.
Sure.
Right.
And sleds. I think someone called them sleds. That's wonderful. You know, it's better than a brick. but that's the allure to it. You have there's late model racing all over the country, and there's great racing all over the country. But where is there a place that a young person can come along and get heavy car experience?
Right.
And this is the market that we're trying to target. And we think that somebody will come along with these Cup cars in a crate motor series or something, and that's wonderful. Maybe it's something we can work together at. Maybe not.
Joe, what tire are you going to use?
Beg your pardon?
What tire are you going to use?
We're talking with several different people at this time, and I can't give you an answer on that, but I can guarantee you we will have tires on the car.
Yeah, but, I mean, you're not going to run radials. Or you might.
I don't have an answer for
that. I got you. Okay.
Fair enough. I would, you know, like I said, we'll have a booth at the PRI show.
Cool.
We're sharing a booth with the Pro Challenge Series. In fact, we're talking about running a couple of combined races. They may come with us on a few of our shows, but we will be down there at the PRI show.
We'll see you there.
Yeah.
Sending out some information. And like I said, this series was truly put together, you know, the day before yesterday. The website was launched today. I guess got the email in that it's up, so it should be available on Google in a day or two. But you can punch it up at supercupstockcarseries.com and get the information on it right now.
It sounds, I think it's exciting. I mean,
me too.
You're mostly going to run, though, you're looking pretty much to run in the Carolinas, maybe southern Virginia.
We're looking at, we feel that most of our cars are in North Carolina, and probably half of our cars are in North Carolina, and the other half are in southern Ohio. So we're going to run between southern Ohio and North Carolina.
Well, Gary St. Amant owned that many cars?
He's got about nine of them between him and
that. There you go.
We're trying to figure out a way that we could have Gary stop by and maybe wave the checkered flag. We'd like to give these some of these young people a chance. So I was kind of hoping that Gary would go on and win that national championship in Hooters. But he won't. I'm sure he won't be over running with us. But his car owner Dwayne Tapman has said he's going to come and run with us. So.
Oh, cool.
We'll hopefully get Gary and Bud to come by and be Dwayne's car owner or crew chief or whatever their position will be. But we're really pleased and excited about this thing. And how I got involved in this is Mike Kirkowski, one of the car owners, has been talking about this for a year. And you've had him on the show, I think, a time.
Sure, sure.
And he came to me and he said, "Joe, this is the hardest thing I've ever done." He said, "You can't get anyone to talk to you. You can't get anyone to take you serious. Help me." So I said, "Yeah, there's nothing to it." So but, I've been working on this just half days here for a few months, like 12 or 13 hours out of every day, working on it, putting a schedule together. And this is an extremely hard thing to do.
Yeah.
The other thing is Dennis Huth had pretty much covered everything that there is about promoting races. This is hard.
Yeah. No doubt about it.
Yeah, is it is the hard, some of the hard parts dealing with the promoters, or is it just all the details?
It's just all the details. You get to these racetracks, and they have their local shows. They have rented shows. The track's rented at different times. They want you to team up with other series and come in and do a combined show. We're just the small guys, obviously, but I still don't want to be on the back stretch. If we're going to go into a racetrack, I want to be on the front stretch. And it takes more effort. It costs more money. There's just so many different things to work out. It's just unbelievable and overwhelming.
Yeah. Obviously, one of the things once you get underway is, we'll do... I'm sure we'll work with you on this sort of stuff, is promoting the drivers, and giving them the publicity and the exposure, because they need it.
Right. Well, let me talk about some drivers.
We
had the two young drivers that came down from Ohio and ran both of our races. Ryan Miller, who won the second race, ran second in the first race, and a young lady out of Ohio named Megan Rettenauer, who came down, and she led 39 of 50 laps at Tri-County. She did such a good job, Mark Nesbitt signed her to drive his car next year.
Wow.
And in fact, if you look on your message board, it's on there.
I see that. I saw that earlier today.
And myself, I've worked with several other girls in the past and trying to get one in the right position. This girl here is a super talent. She's only 16 years old. She led that race and ran in 1690s for 39 laps, and just did just a whale of a job. We had Dexter Knight Sr. in the race. She ran with Dexter, the national late model champion.
Right.
Who else was in that race? Joe Harrison. His son had never had raced other than in our two exhibition races. Did a wonderful job. I call him Hurricane Harrison.
Yeah, he's from up in Hurricane, West Virginia. We want to have him and his son. We were going to do that in October, but I got the flu and we were off for about 3 weeks. And I had planned to have him and his son on. Tell us that little, you know a little bit of the details about that last event that they were in. Where they had everything borrowed or something. Wasn't it crazy?
What was that again?
Well, about Joe Harrison and his kid. I mean, the car was broke or something, and they had to borrow everything. I mean, they had to borrow the screwdrivers.
Yeah, when they came down and run our exhibition race, I think the car belonged to Jody's uncle. I don't know who owned the motor in it. It was quite an interesting thing. I mean, they came and crashed in practice and still ran really good in the race.
And that was Joe's kid's first time out, right?
That was his first time out.
Yeah.
He did a wonderful job. And like I said, the little Ryan Miller kid who was in Lonnie Rush's car won that second race. We didn't have a big car count, but we had one of our people, Jeremy Miller, towed from Iowa to come and run an exhibition race at Hickory.
That's saying something right
there.
Wow.
He came from Iowa. We had Chad Bear came from Richmond or Mechanicsville, Virginia. Two cars, they said Megan and Ryan came out of Ohio. We had a couple of locals, and Larry Wilcox raced with us. Larry Barrett out of Ringgold, Virginia came and raced. Now, Larry is about my age. He's in his late 50s, and he's running with these kids that are 15 and 16 years old. And it was fun to watch. It was exciting just to watch it.
Well, you know, the kids can't keep up with us old guys, you know.
Yeah, they'll have to go at it. But these young kids, you know, it's like Dennis was talking about and Fritz, and when we're talking about Logano and them, these young kids are just—they're super.
They add the excitement that's needed, and I think they're part of the big reason for the resurgence that Dennis was referring to, I believe.
Right.
Yeah, I agree on that. We've got 10 races scheduled, and we're planning on doing. Four of them in North Carolina, four of them in Ohio, probably two of them in Virginia. That's where our cars are, and that's going to be the final factor on where we do these races.
Sure.
Just because of traveling.
Yeah.
But we've looked at different formats. We've discussed running two races on one weekend where someone could run one Friday night, stay over and run Saturday night. And it sounds really good on paper. Or sounds until you put it on paper and it doesn't work.
Well, if you get some cars tore up on Friday, it could affect obviously what happens the next
right.
day.
But it's not even so much that is if you could get home from the second race and sleep in your own bed, it works.
Yeah.
But if you got to stay overnight and keep these people out on
right.
the road, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it didn't work until I started figuring how I'm going to take my officials to these races and have to pay for them.
Right.
That sounded good until I have to pay for it.
That's a whole different world now.
Joe, while we have you here, and since we already run over our time anyway, what are some of the things you could tell us? What are some of your fondest recollections of working with Fritz for 8 years?
Well, one time, we did 2 years in a row. We did all the Pro Cup races, and there was 30 races on the schedule. We're down at Lakeland. We're closing the series out at the end of the year. And he says, Joe, what are you doing next week? I said, I'm going to the beach. I'm going to turn my phone off. Don't call me. He said, well, he said, the beach will still be there. He said, I need you to go to the Snowball Derby. So my wife and I were in the motorhome, so we leave Lakeland up to the motorhome, in the motorhome up to the Snowball Derby. Get there Wednesday morning. I said, Fritz, what do we need to do? And we talked about the procedures and this, that, and the other thing. I said, well, what are the tech tools? And he handed me this 4-inch bladed knife, and he said, this is the only tool you need at the Snowball Derby. When I tell you to poke a car, he said, you cut the sidewall. He said, be done with it. And he just, that thing about Fritz cutting tires is a true story.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, I just you made me just remember that one, yeah.
I have seen people. I mean, I never personally cut a tire, but that's what he handed me for a tech tool. The Snowball Derby. He said, all you need to do is, he said, you have one of these. He said, they'll stay in line. But
did you learn some stuff working around that guy?
Oh, he's an interesting fellow, without a doubt. And in fact, it's part of I'm going to use some of Fritz's ways of doing things to help keep this series going that we're starting. And the older people that are in this series, I've been with Fritz for years, so it's going to be easy for them. The new people, the young people are, I'm going to see. I don't think I can imitate or Fritz, but I'm going to try.
Are you going to pick up that phone every once in a while?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
I talk. Well, that's why I said to Fritz there, he better expect a draft. like, and he said, I heard him say, you know, he's got me on speed dial. Well, he's number 7 on my list.
That's cool, Joe. All right.
Well, like I said, we're really excited about this series, and Dennis was absolutely correct. Positive. We need to have people. They've got to be excited. But you guys need to come to one of our races. And I remember you guys on pit road, I believe at Lakeland one time. You know, get on behind the wall.
Yep. Oh, yeah. That was us.
If you come up to this series, I won't make you sit in the VIP suite. We'll put Skip up there. We'll put you down on pit road.
There you go. There you go. Well,
that's
we'll,
where we like it.
We'll certainly be in North Carolina. I've made quite a few trips this year, and I'm sure we'll make a whole bunch more next year.
I definitely want to catch one of these races.
Right. The thing that you do need to understand, if you come, you'll sign in on our VIP list. I will put you to work doing something.
Okay.
Because I don't have a big staff. So if I see you guys come 2 or 3, you know, that's like half of my staff. So. You know,
well, I got a little announcing experience.
Well, that's fine. We had, when we did this race, I had Mark Nesbitt was announcing.
I read that.
I was running the ground. His car is leading the race.
Yeah.
I imagine it was, but you know, this is what we did. We had his daughter was the trophy girl. His wife was counting the money. My wife was selling tickets.
Sounds like a good beginning to me.
Family affair.
That's right.
It's had, you know, and the thing is, like, Martin and I go back 15 years. We raced late models against each other. You're here back here at Asheville. You know, I prepared a car for one man, and his father and him prepared a car for him. And when he won his first championship in 1995. I'll give you an idea. I don't know if you know the Nesbitts very well, but they like numbers. You know,
oh, yes.
Bankers.
And
they had it figured out that they could come to Asheville Speedway and with a 5.6 average finish, they could win the championship. Well, 10 races into the year, their average finish was 1.25, and they were second. So we told they earned that championship, I guarantee you. Yeah. With his car and our car, between us, we won, 11 of 20 races.
Wild.
It was 14 of 20 races. He won 7 races, we won 7 races. And the difference in the championship wasn't how well we ran, it's how the one bad race that we had. He finished like 10th in one bad race, and we finished 12th. And that's what it came down for, his championship.
Well, you definitely got some good people hooked up with to make this all thing happen. And we will catch up with you, I'm sure, at the PRI show in Orlando.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. Come by.
Oh, we will. We'll catch it all, man. And,
yeah.
I carry a thick notepad that day, you know.
I know what you mean. That 3 or 4 days of that can wear out anyone.
Yeah,
buddy. All right, Joe.
We're going to have, just before I hang up, the sure. young girl that I had mentioned, Megan Rettenauer, will be down there. She's going to sign some autographs for us for a day or so.
We got her in our list here
for
Real Racing USA. She'll be on, not sure when, may not be until January, but we certainly got her in the list.
Right, well, that's wonderful. That's a nice young girl. She interviews well, and she drives the wheels off of a race car.
All right, Joe Schmalling, competition director with the Supercar Series, coming to you.
Super Cup.
I keep saying Supercar.
Supercup. Stock Car.
Stock Car Series.
I keep doing that.
Ian, give us the website real quick, Joe.
What was that?
Give us the website real quick.
It's SupercupStockCarSeries.com.
All right, Joe. We'll be catching you soon.
Right. Make sure they put it in their favorites so they don't have to type that in. That's a lot of letters.
Hey, Joe. Now, I know we're going to go out tonight with this show with something a little different that I think you're quite old enough to remember this one. So don't hang up your computer just yet when you get off the phone with us.
Well, yeah, I'm sure I'm old enough. I'm older than most of the trees on this planet.
Yeah, we got something coming you might appreciate.
All right. Thank you guys for having us on. And please, anyone's listening, look at your message board. There's a tremendous amount of information. And thank you guys for having the message board available for us.
All right. You're welcome.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Good night now.
All right. Joe Schmalling.
And that is the Real Racing USA.com forums. Just go there and click on forums. There's all kinds of crazy stuff.
All good, all the time. 99% of the time. Wow. Now a nice, happy Thanksgiving song. Well, from the staff and crew, Jack Smith and myself, Rick Angies, we want to wish everybody in the racing community all over the world a very happy Thanksgiving.
This song's called Alice's Restaurant.
It's one of my favorite songs.
One of my absolute favorites.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Real Racing USA will return to the airwaves next Tuesday night, right here, 7 to 9, 9:30, or the gray area, as Fritz Augustine says. Thanks for listening tonight. We'll catch you next week. Good night now.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Now it all started two Thanksgivings ago, it was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I went up to visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice doesn't live in the restaurant, she lives in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Facha the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they got a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. And having all that room, seeing as how they took out all the pews, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, we found all the garbage in there, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the city dump. Well, we got there, and there's a big sign and a chain across the dump saying closed on Thanksgiving. And we had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one till we came to a side road, and off the side of the side road was another 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile's better than two little piles, and rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, "Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage, and wanted to know if you had any information about it." And I said, "Yes, sir, Officer Obie, cannot tell a lie. I put that envelope under that garbage." After speaking to Obie for about 45 minutes on the telephone, we finally arrived at the truth of the matter and said that we had to go down and pick up the garbage, and also had to go down and speak to him at the police officer station. So we got in the red VW microbus with the shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, headed on toward the police officer station. Now, friends, there was only one or two things that Obie could have done at the police station, and the first was that he could have given us a medal for being so brave and honest on the telephone, which wasn't very likely, and we didn't expect it. Another thing was that he could have bawled us out and told us never to be seen driving garbage around the vicinity again, which is what we expected. But when we got to the police officer station, there was a third possibility that we hadn't even counted upon, and we was both immediately arrested, handcuffed. And I said, "Obie, I don't think I can pick up the garbage with these handcuffs on." He said, "Shut up, kid. Get in the back of the patrol car." And that's what we did. Sat in the back of the patrol car and drove to the, quote, scene of the crime, unquote. I want to tell you about the town of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where this happened. Here they got three stop signs, two police officers and one police car. But when we got to the scene of the crime, there was five police officers and three police cars, being the biggest crime of the last 50 years. And everybody wanted to get in a newspaper story about it. and they was using up all kinds of cop equipment that they had hanging around the police officer station. They was taking plaster, tire, track, footprints, dog smelling prints, and they took 27 8x10 color glossy photographs with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. Took pictures of the approach, the getaway, the northwest corner, the southwest corner, and that's not to mention the aerial photography. After the ordeal, we went back to the jail. Obi said he was gonna put us in the cell. Said, kid, I'm gonna put you in the cell. I want your wallet and your belt. And I said, Obi, I can understand you want my wallet so I don't have any money to spend in the cell, but what do you want my belt for? And it said, kid, we don't want any hangings. Said, Obi, did you think I was gonna hang myself for littering? Obi said he was making sure, and friends Obi was, because he took out the toilet seat so I couldn't hit myself over the head and drown. And he took out the toilet paper so I couldn't bend the bars, roll the toilet paper out the window, slide down the roll and have an escape. Obi was making sure, and it was about 4 or 5 hours later that Alice, remember Alice? It's a song about Alice. Alice came by and with a few nasty words to Obi on the side, bailed us out of jail. We went back to the church, had another Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, and didn't get up until the next morning when we all had to go to court. We walked in, sat down. Obi came in with the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back each one. Sat down. Man came in, said, all rise. We all stood up, and Obi stood up with the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures, and the judge walked in, sat down with the C&I dog, and he sat down. We sat down. Obi looked at the C&I dog. Then the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and looked at the C&I dog. And then the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one and began to cry, because Obi came to the realization that it was a typical case of American blind justice and there wasn't nothing he could do about it. And the judge wasn't going to look at the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. And we was fined $50 and had to pick up the garbage in the snow, but that's not what I came to tell you about. Came to talk about the draft. You got a building down New York City, it's called Whitehall Street, where you walk in and you get injected, inspected, detected, infected, neglected, and selected. I went down to get my physical examination one day, and I walked in, I sat down, got good and drunk the night before, so I looked and felt my best when I went in that morning. Because I wanted to look like the all-American kid from New York City. Man, I wanted to feel like the, I wanted to be the all-American kid from New York, and I walked in, sat down, I was hung down, brung down, hung up, and all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things. And I walked in, I sat down, they gave me a piece of paper, said, kid, see the psychiatrist, room 604. And I went up there, I said, shrink, I want to kill. And I want to see blood and gore and guts and veins in my teeth. Eat dead, burnt bodies. I mean, kill. Kill, kill, kill! And I started jumping up and down, yelling, kill, kill! And it started jumping up and down with me, and we was both jumping up and down, yelling, kill, kill! And the sergeant came over, pinned the medal on me, sent me down the hall, said, you're our boy. And you feel too good about it. Proceeded on down the hall, getting more injections, inspections, detections, neglections, and all kinds of stuff that they was doing to me at the thing there. And I was there for 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. I was there for a long time, going through all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things, and I was just having a tough time there. And they was inspecting, injecting every single part of me, and they wasn't leaving no part untouched. Proceeded through, and I When finally came to see the very last man, I walked in, sat down after a whole big thing there, and I walked up and said, "What do you want?" He said, "Kid, we only got one question. Have you ever been arrested?" And I proceeded to tell him the story of Alice's restaurant, Massacre, with full orchestration and five-part harmony and stuff like that, and then all the phenomena stopped me right there and said, "Kid, did you ever go to court?" I proceeded to tell him the story of the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and stopped me right there and said, "Kid, I want you to go over and sit down on that bench that says Group W. Now, kid!" And I walked over to the bench there, and there's his Group W is where they put you if you may not be moral enough to join the army after committing your special crime. And there was all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly-looking people on the bench. There's mother rapers, father stabbers, Father rapers sitting right there on the bench next to me, and one, it was mean and nasty and ugly and horrible and crime-fighting guys are sitting there on the bench, and the meanest, ugliest, nastiest one, the meanest father raper of them all, was coming over to me, and he was mean and ugly and nasty and horrible and all kinds of things, and he sat down next to me and said, "Kid, what'd you get?" Said, "I didn't get nothing. I had to pay $50 and pick up the garbage." He said, "What were you arrested for, kid?" And I said, "Littering." And they all moved away from me on the bench there to carry eyeballing all kinds of mean, nasty things till I said, "And creating a nuisance." And they all came back, shook my hand, and we had a great time on the bench talking about crime, mother stabbing, father raping, all kinds of groovy things that we was talking about on the bench. And everything was fine, we were smoking cigarettes and all kinds of things until the sergeant came over, had some paper in his hand, held it up and said, "Kids, this piece of paper's got 47 words, 37 cents, it's 58 words. We want to know details of crime, time, crime, and else kind of thing. Got a safe time to about the crime. Want to know the rest of the officer's name, and else kind of thing. You got to say in the top 45 minutes, and nobody understood a word that he said. But we had fun filling out the forms and playing with the pencils on the bench there. And I filled out the Massacre with the four-part harmony and wrote it down there just like it was, and everything was fine, and I put down a pencil and I turned over the piece of paper, and there on the other side, in the middle of the other side, away from everything else on the other side, in parentheses, capital letters, quotated, read the following words: "Kid, you rehabilitated yourself." I went over to the sergeant and said, "Sergeant, you've got a lot of damn gall to ask me if I've rehabilitated myself. I'm sitting here on a bench. I mean, I'm sitting here on the Group W bench because you want to know if I'm moral enough to join the army, burn women, kids, houses, and villages after being a litter bug." He looked at me and said, "Kid, you don't like your kind. And we're going to send your fingerprints off to Washington, and friends, somewhere in Washington, enshrined in some little folders, and study in black and white of my fingerprints. And the only reason I'm singing you the song now is because you may know somebody in a similar situation. Or you may be in a similar situation, and if you're in a situation like that, there's only one thing you can do, is walk into the shrink wherever you are just walk as they shrink. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant and walk out. You know, if one person, just one person does it, they may think he's really sick and they won't take him. And if two people do it in harmony, they think they're both faggots and it won't take either of them. And if three people do it, can you imagine three people walking in, singing a bar, Alice's restaurant, and walking out? They may think it's an organization. And can you imagine 50 people a day? I said 50 people a day walking in, singing a bar, Alice's restaurant, and walking out. And friends, they may think it's a movement. And that's what it is. The Alice's Restaurant Anti-Massacre Movement. And all you gotta do to join is to sing it the next time it comes around on the guitar. With feeling. So we'll wait till it comes around on the guitar here. Sing it when it does. Here it comes. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. That's horrible. Want to end war and stuff, you gotta sing loud. You could put a lot. I've been singing the song now for 25 minutes. I could sing it for another 25 minutes. I'm not proud or tired. So we'll wait till it comes around again. This time with four part harmony and feeling. We're just waiting for it to come around is what we're doing. All right now. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant, excepting Alice. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. So walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.